And Americans, for all these years, have been looking around for the enemy. They've never been able to find an enemy. So those who control them were able to control them even better by giving them an enemy. That's what Stalin and Churchill and Roosevelt determined at Yalta. Who was going to be the enemy post-war? Turned out to be Stalin. And there was going to be this phony Cold War so that the population would never discover the real enemy. And I'm talking about the population of the Soviet Union as well as the rest of the world. You see, the enemy has always been here. It's your uncle, your aunt, your father, your mother, your brother, your sister, your nephew, your nieces who belong to the fraternal orders collectively known as the Mysteries.
So it's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday, the 2nd of June 2023. We're streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Arts Centre in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream and at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. Also live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, which is available free from all good app stores, anything please but Google. And that app will give you everything you need, pretty much. So you can listen live on there, you can listen to the podcast as soon as we upload it, or I upload it in the evening, and all the extended interviews as well. But it also will ping you just a little while before the show starts, just to remind you, so if you're free at 5 on a Friday afternoon, evening, you get a little ping from your phone saying, hey guys, the show's about to start, do you want to listen to it live? So obviously, but live is the best way to listen. You get it warts and all. We do a little bit of a slightly sanitised version in that various mistakes and errors and things like that get edited out between 8 p.m. and 11 or 10 p.m. when it goes up online. But that really, I mean, it's not an editorial thing really, it's just a bit, make it a little bit tidier. So I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade psyops, smearing the 30 pence a pill ivermectin COVID treatment. And this is something which is very much a discussion over in Bath this weekend at the Better Way conference, where there's all sorts of interesting people there, including some looking at the list, also some rather flaky people. But one of the things I've been in contact with Tess Laurie, who's one of the organisers, is saying, please make sure that you draw attention to the fact that we have over 150 Bilderbergers involved at the front line in making the COVID plandemic happen. So I do hope that gets discussed at some point over in Bath this weekend with all the speakers that are over there. One of them surely must have noticed who's behind the plandemic, because of course if you don't know who's actually behind these things, it's very difficult to counter them effectively. So navigating us through the Fourth Reich matrix on the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution is the Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. And we're hoping to have the Imagining Freedom podcaster Natalie Minnis joining us too in an hour or so. So part one, I'll be looking at some of the bizarre tales that have landed on my doorstep. That is particularly this relationship with Nick Land. And I've been doing a bit of soul searching through Bilderberg about all this, especially since there's so much of a all these different crises. The latest is this AI crisis. Apparently that's going to exterminate humanity. And this is obviously everyone's thinking, oh great, another not great piece of news. Humanity is going to be exterminated not by climate change, but by AI. And this is very dark enlightenment. And during the week I was over in Trowbridge. I put a couple of posts up on Facebook about the museum there, which was all around weaving, and that's the success of many of the towns right across Britain, but particularly Gloucestershire and Wiltshire. You know, as they enclosed the land and kicked all the people off the land in the enclosures, it really took off. Weaving took off, and then of course you had the Enlightenment, which allowed the Industrial Revolution Well, it enabled it all, really, with all sorts of mechanisation. So it wasn't just individuals in their homes anymore that were doing the weaving. It was these massive dark satanic mills that were doing it. So that was the original Enlightenment. Now we've got this thing called the Dark Enlightenment. So not only are we going to be helped by machines who are owned by somebody else to be enslaved, but now the idea is to get us completely enslaved by machines. That's what the Dark Enlightenment's all about, and that's Nick's work. So a little bit about that. In part two, terrorist assassinations in Serbia. Belgrade, of course, is pro-Russian, so I wonder why that might be. Fighting in Kosovo, more drone attacks in Moscow, and the crazy Russians attacking themselves again. Or maybe there's possibly a simpler explanation. Martin, should we just kick off by just talking, because we're talking about it a little bit, I think, in a minute, but the whole idea of the Enlightenment, this was something which, if you look it up, many of the references make reference to this being something of the Freemasons being involved in this. Can you just give us your take on where and when and what it was all about, the original Enlightenment and the idea of opening up society to a closed world, which had been closed by the church?
Well, it was originally a German phrase, Aufklärung, I believe. And then it, of course, in translated into English as Enlightenment. And it's probably best thought of as the progress of modern rationalistic thinking. So the Enlightenment led directly to the modern science becoming the dominant ideology of modern society.
But this is kind of gaslighting, isn't it, really, saying, any rational person wouldn't believe in God?
No, I mean, some of the Enlightenment people did believe in God. They tended to be deists rather than...
So rejecting the Bible, basically.
Yeah, I mean, the Bible, the main thrust of Enlightenment was to rely upon experimental and empirical inquiry, and to question any kind of received wisdom handed down from the past if it couldn't stand up to rational scrutiny. And it was mainly, educated white men, because most people who lived in the countryside couldn't read, so they certainly couldn't read books about the Enlightenment. And, of course, it did, it's got a dark side to it. It always has had, as modernity has had.
Yeah, the fearless pursuit
of
knowledge.
Nevertheless, it's still a fundamental part of the way modern people think.
The fearless
pursuit. We all learn science in schools, and that is as a result of the Enlightenment. People didn't used to learn science in schools at all. There was no science lessons. They learned Latin if they went to school, and they learned grammar, and essentially a medieval curriculum. But in all schools now, primary, secondary, wherever, science is a central part of the curriculum.
Well, they learn, for example, they learn that evolution is fact, don't they, for example?
Evolution is fact, Tony, because there's a lot of evidence to show that
well,
it is.
Well, yeah, but what's happening with something like that is that the whole principle of the Enlightenment has been reversed, really. The idea is that what you're doing is you're putting in front of young people lots of different explanations and getting them to choose their own. You're not just telling them this is the only one.
We're not going to agree about this, Tony, and the Church of England, of which I'm a communicant member, accepts the existence of evolution, as do most mainstream churches. They do. They just do. It's only a minority of so-called Christians who reject evolution.
What about the Orthodox Church?
The Orthodox churches, all the mainstream churches, apart from a minority, and there's always been a minority that never accepted evolution,
This isn't free and open thinking, is it, Martin? I mean, I'm not trying to agree with you. Of course, I never do that. I will never try and agree with you. But it's quite obvious that there's a real change around gone on here as the so-called Enlightenment has come along. So they're saying, oh, actually, the only rational person will only believe this. Well, actually, that's exactly the sort of idea the Enlightenment was brought along to overturn.
You can believe in what you want, but you can't gainsay what in a biology lesson you were going to learn about evolution. In an RE lesson.
Are you going to have a good, really close look at the fossil, Martin? Are you going to have a very close look at the fossil record that challenges evolution?
All right, well, listen, this is a politics show, Tony. Okay? And if you want to, I think your belief that Christianity implies that you've got to reject evolution is simply...
Well, I didn't say that. And I'm quite agreeing with you that, people who are Christians should have different views, and that's a perfectly reasonable thing. But what I'm not agreeing with is the idea that this so-called enlightenment, the pursuit of knowledge in big inverted commas, it tends towards scientism. And I'll be talking a little bit later about this whole idea of the Dark Enlightenment, which is the modern idea, not that we will help that machines and this kind of thing and amazing amounts of knowledge that humans were restricted from having in medieval times, which of course was quite deliberate, the idea is that those machines are going to, they are better than us, and that we're going to have to do what we're told by the machines. Well, we shall see, because this is all happening right now. It was a big topic of conversation amongst the Bilderberg watchers over in Lisbon, was this whole idea that the Palantir technology, the people who are in there, that technology is being used to kill people in a way, like a kind of chess computer. What do you make of that? This idea that you've got a chess computer there, and everyone getting very excited about, a chess computer has beaten a human, the best chess player in the world. Now, can Palantir beat the Russians if it's used to target them, and if it's connected up to the satellites so they can watch what the Russians are doing and let a Palantir computer fight a war?
Well, Carl Riese, I think it's Riise, who's a Danish commentator on global research this week, was saying that the US is betting on being able to create AI faster than its enemies, and therefore will then use AI to try and dominate the world economy and to win wars. And that is...
It doesn't seem to be doing very well, does it? It doesn't seem to be doing very well.
Well, it's a Hail Mary pass, isn't it? But they have got, they're in a position, they think, to develop AI faster than their opponents, and then they're hoping that that will give them an edge in World War III, because they're not doing very well so far, as we all know.
Well, there are some people that think that AI doesn't actually exist, that really all it is a set of algorithms and programmable stuff programmed by humans.
Well, that's right. It's the old principle, rubbish in, rubbish out, isn't it? If the people who design the AI design it poorly, then it won't be able to do what it ought to be able to do. I wouldn't claim that I'm an expert on any of this, but you can see that we are now living increasingly in a society run by autonomous computers.
What do you make of, we've had a massive summit, I think it was, a Pan-Asian summit or whatever this week, Putin, I think it was the Eurasian Economic Forum, that's right, on Wednesday and yesterday. This is something which in a way you could sort of look at as a counter-Bilderberg. Well, I mean, obviously they wouldn't put it like that, but the Bilderbergers, you've got a load of financiers and politicians in there from the NATO countries talking about how they want to do things, as you've just characterised there. Oh, maybe we can use AI to win the economic battle with Russia and China, and yet they are over in Moscow with President Xi there too, discussing how these non-NATO countries are getting together to create a viable economic system for the rest of the world.
Well, it's moving very rapidly. The Saudi-Iranian rapprochement in Beijing was totally unexpected by the Americans. The situation in Syria has changed because Mohammed bin Salman has shaken hands with President Assad in Riyadh, which means that that may lead to a situation where the situation in Lebanon may become more stable. The Middle East is basically making peace by keeping the Brits and the Americans out, which is what they should have done years ago.
So let's have a listen now to a clip from this week from RT. You know, I always like try every week to do something from behind the firewall, that is to say the NATO firewall, which in the NATO countries is keeping us from viewing things like RT. And this is a piece about the Eurasian Economic Forum that's been going on this week in Moscow, hardly reported anywhere here, even in the financial pages of the major papers. Maybe the FT did, but I had a look at a couple of newspapers on yesterday, nothing at all in there about Xi and Putin getting together to say, well, actually, we're going to have a different kind of financial system that the Americans are kind of, well, they can join it if they want, but they're trying to dominate the planet financially and failing. So we need to make sure that we have an alternative system.
Everyone who thinks or acts otherwise brings damage to the world economy. They're shooting themselves in the foot and in the feet of those who have to obey their dictates. And by doing so, they also increase negative trends, hampering their own progress. This is what international experts are writing about, including those from the United States. By pursuing such an economic policy, they strengthen the downward trend of their economic development, again shooting their own foot. Well, that is their choice.
It's all about building on the mechanisms to achieve a fully functional multipolar world here. So discussions really are centering around that and how to improve transport and logistics in a greater Eurasia, monetary and also financial mechanisms, how to settle in new forms of settlements in mutual trade and how to build and expand on that. Now, thousands are taking part in this two-day forum, which brings together government agencies, organized international organizations, media from over 50 countries, and they will be discussing just that, how to achieve multipolarity. We've already heard from the heads of most member states and even from China. Now, all this on the backdrop now as Russia's prime minister is currently in Beijing, where, as we know, he signed a number of agreements and has said that bilateral ties between Russia and China are now at an unprecedented high. And this is a sentiment echoed here as well via a video message that was sent by the Chinese president, where he solidified his commitment and the partnership between China and the Eurasian Economic Union. Let's take a listen.
Under the framework of the state visit to Russia in March, President Putin and I sealed new agreements on connecting the Belt and Road Initiative with the Eurasian Economic Union. The Chinese side is sincerely interested in the deepening and specializing of this field. We are ready to join efforts and strengthen interaction in the interests of new prospects for cooperation on the Eurasian continent.
This will entirely transform the international economic playing field. And Vladimir Putin did stress that there is a need, and we're seeing that from various partners, and that in fact the majority of players in the global arena agree with Russia that there is a need for a more fair, more balanced architecture of economic relations. Let's take a listen.
There are fundamental changes in the international financial system, and Russia is able to adapt, but also to become one of the leaders of this process. We are aiming to reduce the share of unfriendly states' currencies in mutual payments even more. We tend to work more actively with Eurasian Union partners to reach a complete transition to national currencies. This also takes place in other rapidly emerging economies around the globe, including China, India, Latin America, and it is important to coordinate joint efforts to establish a new decentralized global financial system. This decentralization depends on the resilience of all global finances. The more decentralized it is, the more advantageous it will be for the global economy, because it will rely less on crises in the countries which benefit from a global reserve currency. It will make the economy more depoliticized.
So while the West is focused on trying to curtail cooperation with Russia and trying to convince other countries from not doing business with Russia, it's not going to plan. And Russia is in fact building on existing partnerships and developing new ones successfully.
So that's a report from RT there on the Eurasian Economic Forum. Martin, my sense is that they are actually now ready. If the Western economy crashes, that obviously this is going to have some ripple effects, but they're about as ready as they can be to... It's a kind of almost like a great big sea wall they've built for this tsunami.
Well, that's right. And the big question is it possible for them to escape from the consequences of a financial collapse in the West? And I think they've worked very hard to try and ensure that they won't be affected, but it's still an open question.
The Russians have
particularly
actually...
Particularly the Chinese economy is very dependent
yeah.
on its relationship with the United States.
But the Russians have
Russia
got... experience of this, haven't they, in the early 90s with the way that they're... I think it was someone from the IMF that said we're going to make the economy scream. Well, they certainly did that in Russia as the Soviet Union was breaking up, didn't they?
Well, I think the making the economy scream was in relation to overthrowing Allende in Chile initially. They presumed that once Russia had been absorbed into the global financial system, that it would be a biddable member of the Western alliance. But it's turned out quite differently from that, not least because the policy pursued was so egregiously destructive. Jeffrey Sachs, who actually designed the policy for the Gaidar plan, as it was called, he subsequently, if you see what he's saying today, he says, I apologize because it was wrong. We shouldn't have done that.
What's going on?
And you know, it was my fault because I said they should do it, but I was wrong. And I think most Russians have realised now, because of the bitter experience of what they went through in the 90s, that the West doesn't, basically, West doesn't have the answers. What they tried to do in Russia was utterly destructive, and it only stopped when they stopped doing it, and then they started doing something more sensible. So I think the neoliberal philosophy in Russia is dead as a doornail. And, of course, in China, despite the marketization of their economy, they still have a Marxist underpinning to their policies, which is not free market capitalism. And it's the West that believes in that, but it's just a busted flush. Busted flush for the West and busted flush for everybody else.
Well, look, the result of all of this, we're going to turn to one of our Bristol stories now. I mean, it's just horrific. A luxury Bristol retirement village at the former St. Christopher's School is set for planning refusal this week. The controversial plans have prompted hundreds of objections from concerned locals. So I'm not absolutely sure what happened with this planning application. This, Martin, was the special educational needs centre in Bristol, which was shut down the very last minute by George Ferguson in his reign as mayor, and all confirmed despite all the campaign by many of the parents. That special educational needs came up last week as possibly bankrupting the council, and yet it's very disappointing to see the mayor, Marvin Rees, not making more of a fuss and pointing the finger squarely at the Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, and the Conservative government. I mean, it's almost as if he isn't really prepared to oppose the Tory government in Westminster. He thinks it's pointless for some reason. Plans to convert a special educational needs school in Bristol into luxury retirement flats look set to be refused. St. Christopher School in Westbury Park opened 7 decades ago, so it was a little bit like Remploy. These were the things that were set up to look after either disabled people or people with special educational needs, etc., after World War II. Now, one by one, being closed, and no one's supposed to notice. And this one here, they're trying to turn it into a luxury retirement village. And even the council's planning committee, particularly with the St. Christopher's Action Network, which is made up of locals, are saying the scheme is ridiculous and badly thought out. The developers have boasted of their eco-credentials, yet the council's sustainability officer said they refuse to consider any impact of climate change within the building. Even more astonishing is the scheme is meant specifically for elderly people to enjoy their final years. It's incredibly overcrowded and badly designed. Officers say it would not provide a high-quality living environment. We believe our councillors will make the right decisions for Bristol and our community and reject their unacceptable plans. So what we've got here is a brilliant facility for kids with special educational needs, some of the most important children that we pay our taxes to look after in the city, and we want to make sure that they get a decent education despite their various difficulties. And it's just flogged off by the council, and now some greedy developer is trying to pack as many retirement villages into it as retirement homes into it as possible. And the council, it looks like certain people at the council as well as the locals, are just saying this is revolting. Please don't do it here. Go somewhere else.
Well, a lot of special schools were closed down as a result of the 1980 Education Act, which basically said that children with special educational needs should, in principle, be educated alongside their non-special needs peers unless it was not feasible. I think, in principle, that's not a bad idea, But you've got to recognise that some children certainly cannot access the mainstream curriculum, not least because the mainstream curriculum has become extremely narrow as a result of the imposition of the national curriculum and the testing of children at every, you know, they get tested to death, frankly. There used to be one big exam at 11, the 11 plus. Now they do exams every year. And of course, the results of these exams determine league tables of schools, which then determine whether staff are going to, you know, teachers, head teachers in particular, are going to carry on being employed or not. So the whole thing has become a huge kind of obstacle race for the mainstream kids. And of course, the special needs kids simply can't keep up with that. So there's two things you could do. You could change the overall system to make it more flexible. That's what really needs to happen, certainly in early years, where it's become absolutely absurd, the sort of things we do in this country. In Scandinavia, they do 4 years in nursery school, where they do lots of things like building dens, developing social relationships. They don't even try and teach anybody to read until they're 7 years old. And their results at 16 and 18 are far superior to our results. So the way we go at it by trying to make small children sit in rows and learn things when they actually need to be playing isn't even effective. It's pathetic. It's stupid. But that's the way our country's
run.
Well,
that's the way our country's run by people like Bilderberg and Michael Gove, isn't it? And the curriculum I was talking about earlier also, I think, needs very closely looking at. Look, I mean, the big story here, I suppose, with this sell-off of this brilliant institution, St. Christopher's, I think it was a Steiner school, and it was extremely successful with the children who were going there doing really well compared to the fact that they did have learning difficulties, the parents being really happy with it, actually the local education authority being very happy with what they were doing there, to this, you know, basically a bunch of greedy developers coming in saying, how much can we get, how many old people can we pack into here and flog it all off for as much as we can? I mean, this is, I suppose, the background to what we were talking about just now, about the economic differences between East and West.
Well, we've got a fire insurance and real estate dominated economy in Britain, the fire sector, and therefore there's far more money to be made through developing old buildings like this than developing new products for sale on the international market.
Well, it seems like almost the only industry left is finding you know, managing to get planning permission for something which is going to double the money you pay for a piece of land.
That's right. And if you can make money doing that by speculating in real estate, then that sucks all the money out of investment in small, medium enterprises which might sell stuff on the international market. There's been a complete collapse in investment in this country after the Brexit referendum. It's just disappeared. There is no investment going on. And ultimately, there will be a huge economic cost. The Office of Budget Responsibility, which is set up by the Tory government, estimates that we're losing 3% of GDP per year going forward as a result of Brexit. And that is going to undermine Britain's economic prospects for a generation.
I mean, I'm going to be seeing if I can't get some of these people from the Special Educational Needs Group campaign here into the studio, because I just think this is such an important. I mean, we hear all sorts of, you know, we've been hearing for months and months, you know, of all sorts of stuff to do with celebrities this week, all week, about Philip Schofield. These are the things I think that really matter. I mean, obviously, it does matter when a major TV presenter is grooming some young boy to be his lover, and he eventually ends up being his lover, and then he lies to everybody about it. But, I mean, it just seems there's been an absolutely massive amount of cover. We only mentioned it very briefly last Friday. But these sort of things matter, don't they, Martin? Is there any way to change the economy round to make sure that the government do have money for these sorts of schools? Because I'm sure you'll agree, and all your teaching colleagues will agree, won't they, that this is one of the most important things that we pay taxes for?
Well, there's been an increase in demand for special needs, partly because we're more aware now than we used to be of what sort of problems children have.
I mean, is this part of the explosion in autism? That's another thing, isn't it?
Well, that's another issue. Yes, as autism is a major issue, whatever has caused it.
I know what Andrew Wakefield thinks has caused it.
I know. Yes, I know. I'm aware of that. the thing is, if you want to, you know, you've got to make resources available if you want to do stuff about things like this. It costs money. But what we've done is we've bailed the banks out. We're pouring money down the drain in the Ukraine. And I come back to this, Brexit is going to cost 3% of GDP per year, which means that the tax take will be that much lower. And, of course, all of these things add up to a major crash in the UK economy coming quite soon. And then there'll be no money for anything unless we redistribute, which means that we have to take money off the people who've made money during the Thatcher era, the wealthy. They're going to have to, we're going to have to bring inheritance taxes back like we had in the 1950s. Top rate of tax in this country in the 1950s was 95%. 95%. And of course it worked. The wealthy had to pay it. They didn't have any other choice. They couldn't take their money out of the country like they can now. And it actually meant that you've got resources to do things.
I mean, inheritance tax is one way to do it, but that doesn't really address the major problem, which is for many of people's working lifetimes, they're taking their various earnings and they're sticking them away in some sort of foreign bank account somewhere.
Well, that's right. And also, of course, the TESAs allow wealthy people not to pay tax on their own pensions. Whereas, of course, you know, other people, PAYE people, they, you know, all we're doing is paying into the national insurance system, and all we get out of that is the state pension. Everything has been rigged in this country to make wealthy people wealthier. So you see the kind of debate that goes on in the Tory parties: when can we cut taxes? And the answer to that is never, not for at least a generation, because we bailed the banks out. All of the wealthy had their assets protected by having the banks bailed out and by quantitative easing. So in actual fact, they've made far more money out of the crisis than they would have otherwise have done. And everybody else has been impoverished. Real wages have been falling for a generation.
As to what's happening up at St. Christopher's, just looking that up today, Bristol School redevelopment decision delay leaves campaigners disappointed. Bristol City Council had been due to consider plans to transform the 5-acre site at Westbury Park, which used to be the special educational needs school, into an £85 million retirement community and leisure hub. Well, isn't that interesting? Maybe the council should have sold it for £85 million, if that's what this is supposed to be worth. Campaigners have said they're massively disappointed after a decision was delayed on the redevelopment of the former Bristol School site after the plans looked set to be refused. Councillors have been due to meet on Wednesday to consider plans to transform the 5-acre site. But the team said the consideration of the application had been postponed at the request of the applicant. So they pulled out their application at the last minute, obviously realising that there's quite a lot of political and local opposition to the plans. I imagine they'll be putting it in next month or in a few months' time, a slightly altered planning application. That's what they do, isn't it?
Well, that's right, because the planning law in Britain favours developers. It always has, still does. That, you know, unless there's a good reason why they shouldn't do something, they're basically allowed to do what they want. It's part of our laissez-faire traditions.
It's part of a sort of capitalist way of doing things, isn't it? The idea is if you own the land, you can pretty much do what you want with it. And of course, the council, generally speaking, after one of these decisions, is rubbing its hands because it's getting in either more business rates or more council tax from the new properties.
Well, the problem is that what's happened is that central government has cut the amount of money that it gives to local government to fund various things, including special needs and all the rest of it. And therefore, the councils are under pressure to get money from somewhere else to keep their existing services going. So then the temptation is to go along with whatever the developers are saying, because it's a potential new source of revenue. Whereas in the past, when the central government provided a substantial part of what local government did, then they could just say, well, we don't need that revenue. What do we really want to build on this site? Back in the 1940s, when we created new towns and council estates were built right next door to leafy suburbs, that, you know, planning really was quite strong. But of course, it's gradually been turned into a free-for-all for the developers.
And this toll that they brought in
for all the Conservative Party. They pay lots of money. They're the biggest funders of the Conservative Party, which is why they get what they want.
The toll we've now got in Bristol, which is called a clean air zone, where, of course, it's not a clean air zone at all because it forces people to drive much further, producing more pollution across Bristol. And it's really just about doing exactly what you said, Martin, trying to cream it in off of anyone that wants to drive through the city centre. There's a few stories over the last few weeks about businesses that have had to close because there's far less vehicles coming through. For example, in Bedminster, one of the cafes has closed. It's been open for decades because the scaffolding lorries now have to avoid that part of the city. They go elsewhere, and of course they chuck out all that smoke and go a great big long distance around. I mean, this is really one of the most perverse things I've ever seen a council institute, this so-called clean air zone. The other thing is they've made it really so that there is no obvious and clear way around the zone, whereas, I mean, these sorts of zones, when they've done them in London, it's obvious. Like, so for example, if you go around the South Circular and the North Circular roads, you will be just outside the zone and you won't be going into it. Well, here in Bristol, the obvious roads include the zone, so you've got to go around all the little back streets. In fact, where I am in St Paul's, down Wilder Street, we've now got loads and loads of cars and lorries going backwards and forwards along there, because this is one of the roads which is around the edge of the zone. So the council haven't just not thought about this, they've thought about it and they've gone, well, screw the local people, we don't care about them, we just want the money in. And the more people that get confused, the more people are likely to accidentally stumble into the zone and have to pay the fines. We've also got national news story a few days ago about someone who, beginning of the year, was going to Bristol Airport just following the signs on the M5 to Bristol Airport, and they were sent through, just clipped through the corner of the zone, and then they've got on the way there and on the way back clean air zone fines from the council. And they say, well, we didn't see any sort of signs, we were just told to go this way, we didn't even go into Bristol. The reason I mention this is because there's obviously a lot of criticism of this going on, and people have been putting in freedom of information requests saying how many fines for what, that sort of thing, have the council been doing. And you know what, the council have come back and said, we're not telling you. That freedom of information request, I'm afraid, is not going to come your way. It says, revealing number of Bristol's clean air zone fines would be too confusing, says the council. It says the figures would be too confusing at this stage. Publishing the total number of clean air zone fines issued so far would be confusing. The council refused to answer a recent Freedom of Information request asking if the number of penalty charge notices issued under the clean air zone, because making these figures could result in confusion. Well, you know what? It might just result in you showing that the most of these people are, the signage isn't good enough and all that sort of thing. So the other thing I suppose about this, Martin, is that the people who are having to pay these fines are the poorer drivers, not the rich drivers with their nice new Chelsea tractors.
Well, I know your opposition to this has been very, very vocal. I'm actually agnostic about it. I don't really know. I'm not that bothered about it since I don't have a diesel car. And you know, people don't like this. They've got to stand in elections and overturn it.
You know, I've been going through this series of clips from Mark Purdy. And this is one that you might also want to comment on, Martin. It's by Jennifer Bilek. She's talking about the transgender agenda. And I found this is fascinating. She's someone who was recommended to me by Stella Perrett, who comes on this show from time to time, where she talks about where this transgender agenda started and where it's going.
Late 1990s, early 2000s. There was a big shift in the culture from, you know, data, from the digital age and the information age, and it sort of moved into artificial intelligence, transhumanism, robots, nanotechnology, biotechnology, etc. So this is kind of where we're going now. This is like the future trajectory of this. But, you know, Silicon Valley has been pushing a transhumanist agenda for, you know, since the early 2000s, late 1990s. So then Bainbridge meets up with another interesting character, Martin Rothblatt, who is also a transhumanist. And Rothblatt is, he's a transsexual. He's a man that's appropriated simulacrums of women's biology for himself, and he calls himself, you know, transgender or transsexual. And he's traveled around broadly in the culture in many different circles because he's accomplished so many different things. He's very well renowned and very well, you know, appreciated for his accomplishments. So he's been in the tech sector, he's been in the medical sector, he's been in all over Hollywood. You know, he's been on Oprah and he's been on a million different shows, you know, with his robot wife, which he created. Rothblatt wrote a book, and it's really like, it's really a blueprint of what's going on in the culture now. This is his ideology, working off of the work of Bainbridge. Whereas we're going to disintegrate the sexes, the boundary between the sexes. There'll be no youth and age. There'll be no, you know, male and female. There'll be no, transhumanism is like boundarylessness. You know, you're out there in cyberspace. Ultimately, while you're getting there, it's an upgrade in humanity, building yourself with machines, you know, transferring reproduction, human reproduction to the tech sector. In, I think it was late 1980, he got together with a whole bunch of other transvestite lawyers and transsexuals, and they created a document which was the very first gender bill, which brings disembodiment into the law, the sexual objectification of female biology, you know, into parts, and making a human right out of that.
So
right?
What do you mean disembodiment?
Well, where he's going is full-on disembodiment, where everybody lives in cyberspace. We live in a virtual reality. We don't live in our bodies anymore. We're going to be uploaded into cyberspace. Well, in order to sell that to the public, you know, transhumanism and disembodiment as a life, you're going to have to groom them and get them there. And the way to do that is to create this ideology that says that you can choose your sex. That's disembodiment. You can't choose your sex. You are the body that you were born as, no matter what happens to you. I mean, in 200 years, if they dig up my bones, you know, they're going to find a female, you know. You can't change that. So the ideology is promoting the idea that you can, right? So, and they're driving this ideology into children's schools, not only their schools. They're driving it into their entertainment, their social media platforms, their schools, all the organizations that, you know, that cater to children are all jumping on board with this ideology. And this has only happened in the past 10 years. I mean, before this, we didn't hear about this word. We didn't hear transgenderism. We didn't even hear transsexual. 2014, Laverne Cox was on the cover of Time magazine, owned by Mark Benioff. And you know, it announced a transgender tipping point when there was really nothing preceding that to warrant that that would be a tipping point. 2014. It was just like dropped fully formed into the culture. And then from then on, it was just like a chant over and over and over and over and over again. You heard transgender rights are human rights, trans rights are human rights. These huge NGOs, these very huge, powerful, non-governmental organizations serving the LGB community worked hand in hand with international law firms like Hogan Lovell and Denton's and Reuters Next Law and Open Society Foundation lawyers to start to create legal guides for transgender children. So they start to build this edifice of transgender children to drive this narrative, you know, that you can be born in the wrong body. And so we heard all these, you know, initial stories about these poor children born in the wrong bodies, right? Which is now, you know, a decade later, has morphed into just express yourself, right? You can be male, you can be female, you can be non-binary, you can, you know, have both your genitalia. And this is all about self-expression now. So it's really morphed in the course of 10 years into the right to augment yourself in whatever way you see fit. Bainbridge's religious, technological religious cult meets Rothblatt's fetish. And they both take off together, and they're both now in the techno-medical field here, right? And they drive this religion, and it is a cult. They're driving it over media, and people are buying it. I mean, sane people that are intelligent people. People are going, yes, you can be born in the wrong body. This project has, you know, is backed by big finance, big pharma, big tech, and all the corporations, international corporations, international finance houses, international law firms, they're all driving the same narrative. And you have to ask yourself, why would this happen in the span of 10 years? You know, when human rights movements don't act like that, they don't come up like that. They come up against these entities, corporate entities, to fight oppression, not to, you know, to offer them, you know, more profiteering. So all of these people at the top are all thinking about this same thing and thinking about it in the same way. Do you know what I mean? It's like Rothblatt and Bainbridge got together. They have this, you know, ideology that they're forming. Rothblatt has actually written about it. He's written about the technological takeover of human reproduction. He's written about transgenderism being an on-ramp to transhumanism and how to drive that. He's given conferences all over on how to do that. So he's right there. He's starring in this movie, you know, and he's trying to drive this ideology through our institutions. Okay, so then you have all these gay men who suffered through the AIDS crisis, even if they didn't suffer themselves. They watched their brothers, you know, their cousins, you know, die. I mean, the LGBT human rights movement was very, very young when AIDS hit, right? So immediately the medical industrial complex swoops in and is part of this movement now, right? And these philanthropic organizations come up to serve them, right? And to serve the public. So once AIDS dissipates, though, you have these mammoth, you know, what were then LGB organizations, you know, teach them about, you know, safe sex and what, how the thing is, you know, how AIDS is transferred and, you know, help for people, you know, so they were getting all this money, you know. And Big Pharma is profiting off of these AIDS drugs. And then suddenly, whoosh, there goes AIDS, you know. Then the issue became gay marriage for these organizations, right? And late 90s, early 2000 is when the first, when the two major LGBT, what is now LGBT organizations, came up in the United States. You have Tim Gill founded the Gill Foundation, and then you have John Stryker starts Arcus Foundation, which is probably the most significant LGBT organization in the world. Mm-hmm. Arcus Foundation, as well as Gill Foundation, send millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars to our educational institutions, our medical institutions, prisons, organizations that serve the community, churches. They're everywhere. Their money is everywhere. And it's contingent, though, that funding mechanism is contingent upon adopting this ideology of gender ideology. And then these trans organizations started to come up. And this wasn't to serve transgender people or people that thought they were born in the wrong body, but it was to destigmatize this fetish of adult men within the corporate world, within the community, within schools. You know, when you're sending millions and millions of dollars to these cash-strapped institutions, you know, like universities and schools and stuff, you know, and all they have to do is get on board with this progressive ideology. They've been told it's progressive. Who cares? It's part of the LGB, right? They don't really think about what they're doing. And then at the same time, the media is promoting this as a human right. It's a human right. It's a human right. Well, there's thousands of, tens of thousands of children that are identifying as transgender now. And you have thousands of children on these puberty blockers that disrupt your growth, ruin your bones, provide all sorts of complications, water on the brain, et cetera, et cetera. And they usually graduate to cross-sex hormones, which are even more dangerous. And they're going to be taking those for a lifetime, and they're going to be sterilized. And I think the first children's gender clinic came up in like 2007. And now we have hundreds of them all over the United States. Where did they all come from and why? You know, nobody examines the issue. Why is this happening?
So that's the voice of Jennifer Bilek there, talking about the trans agenda. I thought a fascinating discussion that she's having, I think it was last month, no, April, with, gosh, I'm not sure who was asking other questions. In fact, no, whoever it was asking other questions didn't get a chance to get a word in edgeways there because she was just expelling it all out. But I'll put a link up to the full interview up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later. Martin, what do you make of her? This is an idea. I think what she's saying there is that you've got quite a lot of non-profits that have actually been spending millions and millions on this whole, you know, the idea of sort of convincing people that they're born into the wrong bodies.
Well, I think it's very worrying, isn't it? I think the idea that you should give children drugs to prevent puberty is abhorrent. I mean, really, you should interfere as little as possible with people's, nervous systems and endocrine systems. And, you know, the imposition of, you know, obviously Big Pharma provides those drugs and they make a profit out of what's going on. But it strikes me as that people do not know what they're going to grow up to be age 5, 6, 7, even into early teenage years. You gradually develop your social identity in your late teens. And then, of course, as an adult, you're allowed to do things like vote, smoke, drink, drive cars. But, you're not allowed to do that when you're small because it's not appropriate.
I mean, you work professionally in schools. Do these issues come up amongst your colleagues and what do they think?
Well, at the moment, we are waiting for directions from the Department of Education about what we are to teach in relation to this transgender issue, because there hasn't actually been a clear steer on what we are supposed to be doing. So lots of teachers' leaders have been saying, well, look, you need to tell us what it is we're supposed to be doing on this, because you haven't given us a clear steer. The more we debate this, the more I am suspicious of the whole thing. We created in the first place the idea that oppressed groups should have their own spaces where they could talk amongst themselves without being, observed or intimidated by oppressor groups is a quite well-established principle. So we had, the Black Panthers were for black people, yeah? And that was part of the whole transition away from everybody's got to be the same, they've all got to have the same ideas and so on. And it was quite important that, gay groups were for gay people, yeah? People who are not gay do not understand what being gay is about. People who are gay should have groups of their own just for gay people to talk about what they feel. The same goes for women. Women have to have separate groups to talk about stuff. Without men there, it's quite important. And this goes back, actually, to the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century in the debates that went on in Poland, Lithuania, between the Polish Socialist Party and the Jewish Socialist Bund. The Polish Socialist Party took the line that Jewish socialists should just join the Polish Socialist Party. The Jewish Socialist Bund, on the other hand, said, no, we are not in the same cultural space as you are, not least because most Jews spoke Yiddish rather than Polish. So they had a completely different language and they also had a completely different experience of the society. You know, they were discriminated against in all sorts of different ways. And, they lived in ghettos, effectively. And they said, well, we've got to organise ourselves within that. That doesn't mean we're not in alliance with you. We're all socialists. But, we're going to have a separate structure. And that separate structure, of course, persisted right up to World War II, when the Armia Krajowa, the Polish Home Army, staffed largely by Polish socialists, supplied weaponry to the Jewish Socialist Bund activists inside the ghetto to kick off the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. Now, I think what's happening with this transgender stuff is that all of that historical memory is being erased, and corporations and very pushy individuals are basically saying I think there is a legitimate case for trans people to have trans meetings with other trans people, but you can't say that we have therefore allowed to trespass into women's only spaces. You can't, just as I can't be a member of a black only group because I ain't black. That's the basic principle behind all of this.
Okay, Martin. Right, thanks anyway. I'll put a link up, as I said, to the full interview there on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. There's also a fascinating interview on strategicculture.org by Jennifer Bilek, how LGBT nonprofits and their billionaire patrons are reshaping something. I can't quite read the other. Reshaping the world, that's right. Talking there about the open George Soros' Open Society Foundation providing a lot of the funding for this, as well as somebody called Tim Gill and his Gill Foundation, and various individuals who've been pushing this, professors, etc., being funded by these foundations. Anyway, I'm also joined in the studio now by Natalie Minnis from the Imagining Freedom blog. I suppose that's the best way to introduce you, really. But I see most of your stuff, actually, is to do with climbing mountains in Scotland. You're down to here for this conference at the weekend, the Better Way conference, organised, I think originally they were organised by Tess Laurie and her, what was the organisation
called?
World
Council for Health.
Right, okay, well that's, yeah, but there was an organisation before that, which was pushing this whole idea of ivermectin. Now, I mean, I've had ivermectin, I found it incredibly successful. I was lying in bed for about a day when the Queen had COVID, with the Omicron, whatever it was, COVID, lying there. And then suddenly my wife said, why don't you have some? I've just had some ivermectin, I feel loads better. So I thought I was a bit of an idiot. I've been talking about it for a year or something. And it actually does the job, and it's very cheap. I first came across you, Natalie, when you got in touch with me about Klaus Schwab. So maybe that's the best way to start here, yeah. Because the World Economic Forum is such an important thing nowadays. The money that they have is so great, the amount of money they've got, that what are they doing? Well, they're actually doing this partnership deal with the United Nations. So the United Nations is strapped for cash. The individual governments, as we've just been hearing from Martin and to do with the Asian Economic Forum in Moscow this week, we haven't got any. The governments don't have the money to spare. But Klaus Schwab and his friends at the World Economic Forum do. So they're increasingly taking over various institutions, not least of which is the World Health Organization at the UN. So tell us a little about Klaus.
Yeah, I'm not an authority on Klaus Schwab, but I just became interested in him when he suddenly sort of hit the headlines. Was it late 2020 or 2021 with this sort of just, you know, determining the way we were going to come out of the whole pandemic crisis? And I thought, who is this man? I had a sort of hunch that he might be involved with the Bilderberg Group. And
he was on the steering committee.
He was, yeah. But at the time, no one was saying that. Yeah. So I started looking him up to see, to find out more about him. And I found out all about his, family background, as did lots of other researchers. So I think in a way it's kind of old news what I've found out.
It is in a way, but it's important to be reminded about these things. Sometimes
yes.
I think we hear a little blip on the news about it and then we forget about it. Actually, there's a couple of pieces. I mean, I've been replaying these interviews with Mark Purdy, the organic farmer who first called
Very
out the problems of organic phosphates. I recorded that in 2000. Well, it never made the news, although he did in some, and when he did make the news, usually someone would turn up on his farm and cut his telephone lines so that he didn't make the news the next day with all the follow-up phone calls. But so just remind us a bit about his family, because he does have an interesting father, particularly, doesn't he?
Eugen Schwab. And apparently he was the head of the Swiss engineering firm called Escher Wyss, and that was under the Nazis. Apparently they used slave labour to produce machinery. And so that obviously helped the Nazis at the time. Apparently he was in Nazi groups. I found this article in Newsweek basically talking about all these wild conspiracy theories and debunking them. But the conspiracy theories they were talking about were ones that I'd never heard of, showing a picture of saying that it was his father and it wasn't. And then at the end, they were implying that all this was conspiracy theory, but at the end they actually said, yes, Eugen Schwab was involved with nationalist socialist groups and they were using slave labour in the factories. And I think that's really important, not because I want to put someone down about who their parents were, but because it seems to be linked to colonialism, because the Nazis really wanted to use labour. They were very envious of the UK, well, British colonial empire, and they wanted to build up their own colonial empire. And I feel that these have all been built up on the backs of people's labour. In fact, I've heard some very interesting comments about the economic situation that we're in now, suggesting that capitalism has been so beneficial to us because it's brought us all of this wonderful advances in technology and things. But actually, that's only part of it. I think a lot of it has to do with colonialism. And I get the impression that Schwab and his foundation is almost trying to kind of push that, because colonialism's sort of, you know, it's built on a hierarchical sort of society, but people have demanded equal rights, obviously, and society has become very different. And I just get the impression that it's no coincidence that Klaus has this background in this Escher Wyss factory. Apparently they had links to South Africa. Well, they were producing heavy water or something for South Africa. But
That means he was involved in the German nuclear weapons program.
I think it's no coincidence, really.
This is, I think, a fascinating. I mean, I love this because, particularly after having several conversations with Manfred Petrich, who's sadly no longer with us, but his father was actually a Nazi jet engine designer working for Messerschmitt, it was BMW made the engines, the jet engines for the Messerschmitt 262, the first German fighter that was jet powered in the war. Funnily enough, just turned up on the scene almost exactly the same time as the British, the Meteor jet. But this whole aspect of German nuclear weapons, it shouldn't be too surprising for people to think that they were testing this technology, because after all, It was in Berlin in 1938 that the atom, before the war started, that they first split the atom. So these were largely Hungarian and German nuclear scientists that were dreaming up all this stuff. So in a way, it's amazing that I suppose the intelligence people will say, well, we made sure that all that technology came over to us by the time of the end of the war. So what do you make of the WEF now and Schwab's role? He's got this kind of few photographs of him around with this kind of weird outfit on where he looks like something from Star Trek, or some sort of evil guy from Star Trek. But he gets lots of honorary degrees from lots of universities, largely because nowadays organizations like his actually fund a lot of our universities.
I didn't know specifically about that, but yeah, I know that obviously the Gates Foundation's involved in a lot of the funding as well. There was a very interesting article in The Guardian, I don't know if you saw it, from January of this year, saying that the title was "Mutiny Erupts Among WEF Staff Over the Role of Mr. Davos." And apparently this group of staff said that he's seen by this group of staff as a law unto himself. And they actually contacted The Guardian and said that he'd surrounded himself with nobodies, their words, who were incapable of running the WEF, and that there's no succession strategy. And
that also sounds like the Tory party, doesn't it?
Coincidentally, yeah. And it was described as a viper's nest. So there was a quote saying that Klaus picks his leaders using the same criteria that Putin uses to pick deputies: loyalty, guile, and sex appeal. So I don't know about Putin, but that's what the quote was.
I've seen Putin, they do televise a lot of the meetings where they're having with their civil servants over in Russia, and to see him bawling out the civil servants for not delivering what they said they were going to be delivering, I think that's one of the ways that in Russia they want to make sure that they've got decent managers in as well. That's one of the things I've seen over the years.
Was just one other thing that was interesting in this news article from The Guardian. It said that there's been discussion about a possible successor if Klaus Schwab does pop his clogs, because he is 82 now. And I don't know if you heard who this person is. Tony Blair?
Oh, my God. Would he be arrested before or after he gets put in as the head of the World Economic Forum? Well, Yeah, he's the kind of guy that would love doing that job, I imagine. Anyway, fascinating. But, I mean, I also want to talk to you a little bit about the mountaineering stuff, because mm-hmm. you do spend a lot of time climbing hills.
Yeah.
In fact, I confess, I had to laugh at the last one, because you look absolutely knackered at the top of the hill. So it's not an easy thing to do, is it? But
no.
Tell us a little bit about these Munros that you go around and why you do it.
There's Munros which are 3,000 feet or more higher, and there are Corbetts, which are 2,500 feet or more, and then there's also Grahams, which are 2,000 feet or more. And it's just basically a kind of challenge or an obsession or both. So I just like a challenge. I've climbed 200 Munros, and I decided to stop at 200 and focus on the Grahams and Corbetts just to give myself another challenge. And quite often when you're doing these hills, it really helps if you want to just knock off a few of them to camp. And I think that's where things get a little bit political, because in Scotland, we're lucky that we have this kind of right to roam. We can camp almost anywhere as long as it's not someone's garden.
Well, that's right. We've been having this discussion about Dartmoor with even the army saying, hang on a minute, we're using this for training. So we're not going to stop people being able to wild camp in Dartmoor. So, but that's a general right in Scotland.
Mm-hmm. And I think people have fought for that right. But I visited Costa Rica in 2015, and it was actually for because of one of my relatives was at college there and graduating. And at the time, I was pretty broke, but I scraped up the money to travel there, and I did have a lovely time. But I found there were so many places that were closed to me, and Costa Rica is really presented as this wonderful kind of natural place, lots of national parks. But in fact, the national parks there are used really to keep people, not so much to keep people out, but to keep people paying. You know, there's a kind of fee for getting into each one. Mm. So in Scotland, you could go and climb Ben Lomond or Ben Nevis, as long as you can get there and then you can climb it. No one's going to stop you. But in Costa Rica, if you want to go and climb a particular mountain, you've got to pay the, whatever it is, maybe $15. But I do remember that my sister was there. Her two kids wanted to go on this long zip slide. It was $75 each. And we weren't even allowed to go and watch them. We had to sit in a cafe because I think they wanted to charge for expensive photos. So this is the kind of thing that I think this Dartmoor thing could be leading to.
Isn't it difficult to enforce that? The idea is if you're wandering on a hill and you go, how are they going to actually come? Are they going to come and find you with
good
a helicopter
point.
And a drone and charge you on the spot? Or
to
me, this is just it's a bit like our clean air zone here. Mm-hmm. That it's just a toll. The idea is the access to the natural environment should of course be free. Mm-hmm. This is a free gift to mankind. Ladies and gentlemen, why should anybody?
Well, we were
have to
born
pay?
On this planet. That's why I think it's one of the fundamental rights of human rights. We were born on this planet. We should be allowed to sleep on it.
Yeah, but you're painting a bit of a rosy picture of Scotland, because I know I've had friends who've been trying to squat in Scotland. Mm-hmm. So it's okay, you can camp out overnight and you can walk pretty much where you want. But when it comes to actually finding somewhere permanent, you get immediate police action, very much like actually the residential squatting here in the UK does in Scotland. But I wanted to talk, because I had a very interesting experience up in Scotland doing some walking too. I'd just like to take you through this, because this a relationship I had with this guy Nick Land, who wrote this essay The Dark Enlightenment. I was at Bilderberg, I was thinking it through, because there was so much in front of me to do with these various, particularly with artificial intelligence and the various different crises. And now apparently we've got another crisis, the AI crisis. We're going to become extinct because AI is going to wipe us all out if we're not careful. This is accelerationism, and this is his idea, basically. I mean, it seems to be this old school friend of mine's idea. I first came across this when I was interviewing last year David Livingstone about his book Transhumanism, The History of a Dangerous Idea. And he mentioned this guy, Nick Land. And at the end of the interview, I said to him, David, who is this guy? Can you tell me a bit about him? And I said, I know him. I know him. I went to school with him. I was good friends with him. Nick the Nazi was his nickname from between 1976 and 1978. I was in the Air Cadets with him from 1975, roughly. Spent most Saturdays around his house playing war games. And I mean, it's a bit peculiar. And then, he suddenly in 1990, 1978, he suddenly became a communist. He didn't want to speak to me anymore. I don't know. It wasn't just because he was a communist. We went on holiday. I should post one of the photographs from the holiday because we came down here to Wales just before we got our O-level results. And so he became a communist in 1978. And I grabbed him in school, in the sixth form college one day. And I said to him, Nick, this whole thing about God, right? We've been talking about this. And this is the sort of thing that kids talk about at school. Is there such a thing as a God? I said, I'm interested in what you say, because you said a lot about the Nazis, etc. What about God? He said, well, pause for a minute. He said, well, I think it's about 50-50 whether there's a God or not. And I'm thinking, that's an interesting answer from Nick the Nazi. So anyway, he wasn't a Nazi at that point anymore. He was a communist, and he went off to Warwick University after studying at Sussex University, when I went to see him. But that had a big effect on me. And when I was getting my A-level results, I was down Layham's Road, where we lived in Kent, Hayes in Kent, where the school was. And just before I opened my A-level results, I was sitting there thinking, gosh, this is an important moment. You know, when you are, is it going to be rubbish, or is it going to be, am I going to go to the university or college I want to go to? And I said a prayer. I said, God, if you're out there, tell me who, you know, show me that you're out there. Just a quick prayer before I opened it. But I thought quite carefully about it, because I think my own idea is, look, if you don't get this right at that age, you're going to spend the rest of your life just bumbling around, and you may have got it all wrong. So that was a little prayer I said at aged 18. And then within a few months, I found myself in Scotland walking and up in the Cairngorms. And it was probably September the same year, because I've just been putting this together in my mind. And a few months later, up in the Cairngorms, the weather came down, and I'm sitting there shivering on a rock, completely lost. Slowly but surely, my map is melting because the rain is dissolving my map. And I'm thinking, oh, God, I really didn't want this. And I'm starting to shiver, getting a bit hypothermic. And I said, well, God, I'm sorry. I don't want to die. If you're out there, help me. And after about 15 minutes, the clouds parted, and I saw this little bothy. And I went for the bothy, and nothing could stop me getting to it. After about an hour, I reached it, and I was all right. But without that bothy, I wouldn't be sitting here now. Mm-hmm. So and without God, because this was a very special moment for me. And I wonder how many youngsters at that age think that same sort of question. Mm-hmm. It's not really a fair thing to ask you.
No, but I think it's a really important issue, because there's something about mountains. Maybe this is why I love them so much. I had quite a spiritual experience on a mountain, which I won't go into just now, but it was back, in the 90s. Mm. And I wasn't really in trouble, but it was very spiritual. And I think there is something about those high places that they intensify the life experience, certainly. And also, there's definitely something spiritual, even just in people's reaction to the nature around them. It's very special.
Bilderberg means, apparently in Dutch, picture mountain.
Oh.
So they obviously like being up the top there. And obviously Davos also happens at the top of the mountain. That's largely to keep away the protesters, because it's so cold with the ice and the snow. But, you know, I mean, I think also we really do need to connect with our natural environment.
Totally.
And it's so important, because our cities nowadays are becoming almost like everywhere you step, you've got to pay this, you've got to pay that. There's no, I mean, amazingly, when we're over in Portugal, everywhere there's free water. Mm. Here in the UK, what happened to that? Well, you know, if the local authority can't provide free water, what on earth is it up to? What's the point?
And that's another thing about Costa Rica, the number of people that seem to be crammed into San Jose, the capital city. It's as if they've got all the people in the city, and then the wealthy people and the honeymoon visitors can enjoy the nature. And I think nature should be for all. I feel that really strongly. In fact, you were talking about how would they manage to cordon it off and stop people getting in. Well, there's a really interesting article that I read, written by, who's the writer? McLeish? I can't remember his name now. Cameron McNeish. And it was from 2013. But this is an issue because the Allerdale estate, it has one Corbett, but I've noticed from people's photographs, friends' photographs, they have all these wonderful signs saying protected area because of nature and rewilding. And they seem to be giving the impression that it's all about the animals. And it's actually been kind of an ongoing battle with the owner, who's Paul Lister, and he's the MFI heir. And he wants to introduce wolves and bears and lynx and boar and bison. And apparently Cameron McNeish was invited along to this meeting where they were showed around the estate. And then the subject of this electrified fence came up. And apparently that's how he wants to protect the outside world, well, his kind of nature from the outside world by building an electrified fence. And it's 50,000, I think he owns 23,000 acres, but other people have said, sort of joined in, so it's a total of 50,000 acres that would be electrified so that people couldn't.
I'll tell you a little story about this, because I was up at the Reforesting Scotland conference, must have been about 1998, and this issue of rewilding came up there. And there was an English guy, who was at the conference giving a little talk about this. And as soon as he stopped and started asking questions, a great big, tall, dark-haired fella from Neudart stood up, which is this, it's not actually an island, but it's a pretty isolated community on the west of Scotland, stood up and he said, "Ah, you're really telling us that we're not allowed to walk in our own country, English boy."
Exactly.
And well, so said. what's been happening, and he got I don't know, whatever it was, idiot of the conference award or something, because it just went down like a lead balloon at the Reforesting Scotland. So there is also this idea that if you're putting these dangerous animals in, there was a reason why they were killed off, because they're dangerous, and even foxes will take a small baby. If your French windows are open.
Yeah, people used to have drawers to protect their babies from the fox. Well, maybe not foxes, wolves in those days, yeah.
Wolves are a little bit more hard to handle.
Yeah.
Quite better organised than foxes.
I actually think I can kind of understand the thinking behind rewilding, but I think if it happened to the extent of bears, then there would be a rearming to go along with it. Because in the States where they have bears, they also have guns.
Yeah, and also the Hermann Göring was quite into all this stuff. He wanted to bring back all these old species into Nazi Germany, so right. I'm a little bit concerned about that. Anyway, talking of Germany, this whole subject did come up on Al Jazeera the other week, where they're now talking, the German farmers are now saying, and of course the idea is, you know, if you've got dangerous animals, people can't go for a walk there. It's just a way of, almost like guard dogs, effectively, is that this is the way that many of the livestock farmers over in Germany right now are feeling now. Do we really want to have these wolves taking our livestock? Because apparently they're not allowed to shoot them unless they can prove that that wolf has actually taken several livestock. They have to just stand there and watch them, the wolves hunting the lambs and the sheep, etc. Which fits, I suppose, into this wider agenda about trying to get rid of livestock. We've seen this week the National Rivers Authority, not they don't exist anymore. It's the Environment Agency and certain campaign groups, obviously foundation funded campaign groups, saying that the livestock farmers around the River Wye in Wales must stop breeding livestock because that livestock's runoff is going into the rivers. Well, it's always done that. And if you've got a proper Environment Agency, they make sure it doesn't happen. Anyway, let's go back over to Al Jazeera a couple of weeks ago, looking at what is going on in Germany with these marvellous rewilded wolves eating the farmer's sheep.
Sheep grazing freely is becoming a rare sight in Germany. Shepherds tasked with maintaining grassland are keeping their herds behind electric fences equipped with cameras to protect them from a new enemy. This farmer filmed a wolf attack in broad daylight. With the help of guard dogs, her sheep narrowly escaped. Verena Janke has been less lucky. In recent years, she's lost around 150 sheep to wolves.
We're fighting a battle we can't win. They want us to do more to protect our sheep, but it's impossible. We love our job. We work 7 days a week. I grew up with this. It's very difficult to see how everything has changed.
Conservationists see the return of the wolf as a success story. Around 2,000 of the endangered animals have been counted in Germany since the first packs were sighted again at the beginning of the century.
For many decades, wolves were merely characters in German fairy tales, but increasingly they have become a scary reality for these sheep and other farm animals, so much that it has led to a confrontation between farmers and conservationists, a conflict that is increasingly turned emotional.
Employees at one environmental organization received a grim warning when a severed head was dumped at their office in April. It's unclear who is responsible.
It shows how desperate some of them are, but it also shows that they are not interested in normal conversation, in normal ways to find solutions.
Christiane agrees that under certain circumstances, wolves can be shot, especially if they are known to attack sheep regularly. But some politicians want to go further. This is what the Bavarian leader said on German TV.
I want to make this very clear. Wolves have no place here.
He says the future of farming is at stake if wolves are not culled. The European Parliament recently adopted a resolution to downgrade the wolves' protection status to help farmers. But EU environment ministers say the bloc should do more to protect the animals. Hunters in Germany are urging politicians to make a decision before people start taking the law into their own hands. They are also concerned that humans could be next.
Wolves are smart creatures. Over centuries, they went through natural selection based on their intelligence. That makes it difficult to protect cattle against them, but on the other hand, their intelligence means they understand that if we kill one member of the pack, they will quickly learn their lesson.
It's only one of the possible solutions to maintaining a balance between humans and wildlife, a balance that's currently under threat. Stapfasen, Al Jazeera, in Lower Saxony.
Yeah, so obviously the farmers over in Germany having a bit of a hard time there with these wolves taking their sheep. What do you think, Natalie? Something seems to be going on here where, I mean, making a connection with the Nazis might be a bit unfair because obviously we do want to protect our wildlife, but we don't really want wildlife that's going to be biting the heads off lambs and attacking people or humans.
Yeah, it's almost as if wildlife has a potential to be weaponized. It seems, I don't know, so many people love the idea of wolves and even bears coming. I mean, people go to Alaska and they want to see the bears. You know, they want they're, you know, part of nature.
Rebecca Wrigley is the name of the woman who's in charge of this Rewilding Britain campaign. She is the partner of George Monbiot, who's been writing in The Guardian. I mean, it's very little actually connecting the two, and it's almost as if they're slightly embarrassed about the fact that they're married or together, living down in Totnes now. But very strange. And then there he is saying how we've got to get rid of livestock in The Guardian.
Yeah.
So there's something a little bit peculiar going on here. It seems to me they're not being quite open and honest about what their agenda is.
Because he did that film about, was it 10 years ago or so, and it keeps coming up, and people keep sharing it every now and then on social media, showing how, was it Yellowstone Park, apparently was regenerated by bringing in predators for the local. I can't remember. We've got deer that running wild here, but
are they going to bring back the Tyrannosaurus Rex? Is that thought to be? You know, if they can find an egg or something and make a new one of those up, will they let those wander
around?
It's
a very controversial subject, and I can see why. I can see why some people say, "Okay, we've got deer running wild in Scotland and destroying all the trees." But I think it's not something that you just want to suddenly bring in. I mean, what about the things they've done in the past with the I was going to say stoats, the mink that brought in the 40s and
grey
got
squirrels.
Rid of the water vole.
Anyway, look, so you've got something in common with us here in Bristol, haven't you, up in Glasgow, in that you've got this clean air zone, a LES, not a ULES or a CAS, but a LES.
Yes.
So how long's that been going for and what's going on up there?
So it officially started on the 1st of June on Thursday, and that was just when I was leaving on the train. There were lots of police around, probably for something completely different. The thing is that people are really angry about it, and I get the impression that a lot of people have just woken up to the implications of it, because it really can hit small businesses, big businesses as well, but if you can't get your products delivered or if you have to invest in new transport, it's costing people a lot of money. And in fact, I wrote to three of my local councillors, because I live south of Glasgow in Ayrshire, and I'm very concerned about the way things, it's just being pushed and pushed and pushed. So I just wrote to them discussing the implications. One of them wrote back and sounded quite concerned about it herself. But I do think people are starting to wake up to the implications. My car actually is from 2012, but it's still allowed, permitted. I don't know how that works, but the only reason I go into Glasgow these days is to give friends lifts, usually to the hills. Mm-hmm. So again, those friends are talking about how wonderful it is that they're putting in more cycle lanes and things. But once they stop being able to get a lift, if my car fails the LES test, things could be different. And I think basically it seems to have started in London with the ULEZ. London's a very different city. It doesn't have the hills for a start that Glasgow does. So you have to be quite fit in Glasgow to be a cyclist because there's lots of very steep hills. The transport isn't nearly as good. We've got an underground, but it's nothing like the London underground. The bus system, quite often it's impossible to even get a bus. When it works, it's great.
That sounds like Bristol.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, sometimes they work. You know, you certainly can't really rely on it. But there's a larger agenda here, surely, and that is that the idea is that the cars are bad, they cause pollution. In a way, what's happened is, I mean, I can remember London in the 1980s where Ken Livingstone brought in this reduction in the fares of the London transport, fares fair, they called it, and halved the fares on all the buses, all the trains.
Mm-hmm. I remember that. I was in London just at the tail end of that.
Right, well, they also brought in the travel card, the idea that you could use it on a train and a tube and a bus, that sort of thing. And that was the Greater London Council that Margaret Thatcher abolished for that. And they were told they can't do it. You know, even though they got elected on the basis of slowly making public transport something which was subsidised through the rates, you ended up with something like 2,500 less serious accidents on the road on the years that had happened. So this is another way of doing things. What seems to have happened is now everyone's forgotten about that experiment, which was, well, it didn't fail. It was a massive success, mm-hmm. but it was nobbled by the Conservatives in all sorts of different ways. They're now saying, well, I'll tell you what, because everyone is now dependent on their cars and because the public transport is so expensive, because it's been privatised, what we're going to do is we're just going to charge tolls for everyone that uses the roads. And of course, this is the same sort of thing that you get in Europe. Say, for example, in Portugal, a lot of the motorways, you have to pay a toll. In France, the same. So they're moving towards road pricing, aren't they? Isn't that the idea?
Yes, definitely. We can see it whenever you travel. Whenever I drive on the car in England, I go through these areas where they're reconstructing the motorways. And I don't know exactly what they're doing, but I think it's going to be all tied up with possibly...
the smart motorways.
Yes, motorways, 5G or whatever it is.
Avoid at all costs, so they can, folks.
Yeah, they can read your number plate and check whether you've paid your toll.
Yeah,
I'm guessing
also,
that's what it's about.
If your car starts to splutter and you start to break down, chances are a lorry will thunder into the back of your car because there's no
hard shoulder. It's crazy. I just don't understand. And the other thing about Glasgow is that the research, people are flinging this all over Twitter, all over social media, but this research shows that the air does meet the standards required, or the requirements. The air is pretty clean since they got rid of the diesel buses. That's made a huge difference. And also there's a chart on Our World in Data which shows that CO2 levels in the UK have fallen to levels that were the same levels as the 1880s. And there weren't any cars in the 1880s.
Well, that was coal, surely, and, mm-hmm. you know, all that sort of pollution,
yeah.
which
so
has now been
got rid of.
So that's
what causes, industry is what's causing this pollution, not cars.
Well, it could be a lot of the lorries. Also, we here in Bristol have got the incinerators that have opened up at Avonmouth, so they will get planning permission from the council, no problem, and they're just upwind, and all the muck from the incinerators comes. So there's something going on, isn't it? What's happening is the public are not being told. And as I said in the article earlier on, our mayor, Marvin Rees, is just refusing to allow the Freedom of Information requests asking about the Clean Air Zone fines. Martin, I know you've been very patiently hanging around in the background there. What do you make of what Natalie's been saying about what they're doing in Glasgow there?
Well, I listened to all the arguments about this, and like a lot of things in life, there's going to be different points of view about this.
Isn't
stuff,
it a toll? Isn't that just what it is? That the council are charging people
that's a wider question of why it's local.
Aren't they behaving like a business that's got a potential revenue stream and they're switching it on?
Well, the slashing of central government grants to local authorities have pushed them in the direction of trying to find new revenue streams, that's for sure. But
why don't they, as it's a Labour council, put it on the rich people? I mean, the rich people who've got these brand new cars aren't paying anything.
Well, because the goal of it is to get rid of these old-fashioned cars, which are just supposedly polluting. Mm-hmm. I think any scheme, if it's not properly thought through, will obviously, you shouldn't just impose it without trying it out and seeing what happens. Ultimately, the goal, presumably, is to stop people driving the cars into the... into the zone so that you don't collect any money. You just deter people from they don't buy cars which you're trying to get those kind of cars off the road. Now, all of these kind of social engineering projects are either viable or unviable, and you've got to actually just work out what it is you're actually trying to achieve. And of course, you know, we need to, you know, as you said, in London, if you'd carried on down that road that Ken Livingstone started in the 80s, you could have free public transport. In Tallinn, in Estonia, public transport is free. In Seattle, in the US, public transport is free. And it's actually quite a logical thing to do. If you've got free public transport, people aren't going to get the car out to go downtown. They're just going to hop on the bus. And, of course, you can do that if you want to do it, but we don't want to do it because our society is dominated by finance capital, and they want, you know, they're looking for opportunities to make profit, not to, you know, not out of monopoly control of things that people have to have. And, of course, ultimately the answer to this is socialist planning. That's what I'm bound to say, isn't it?
Well, I think you're right. You certainly do need a plan, and you've got to have some kind of control of the infrastructure, which is what the finance capitalists seem to hate. Anyway, look, I mentioned Mark Purdy a minute ago, and we're going to have a listen to a little instalment from him this week. I did promise at the beginning of the year I'd get through these by the summer, and we're kind of like getting towards, we're in June now, and there are only 8 parts, but I haven't managed to crack through them as quick as I wanted to, so we're going to do that again this week. This one's a bit shorter than last week's, and here is Mark, organic farmer, who sadly passed away 5 years after I did this interview with him back in 2000. He's talking here about all the consumer pressure there's been to ban these hideous organophosphate pesticides, which were being used, well, actually the farmers across the country, apart from him, he took a high court case to stop it, were being forced to treat their cows with this organophosphate pesticide, which is poured along their spine and just sinks into their body, permeates their entire body. And what was happening is not only were they getting mad cow disease, but consumers that were eating the meat from these cows were getting BSE and starting to go a bit crazy. Well, not BSE, CJD, the human version. So what an absolutely disgusting thing for the Ministry of Agriculture to allow to happen. Anyway, Mark was the one that pointed it out. And he did this interview back in 2000. And this section about the consumer pressure to ban organophosphates.
Organophosphate sheep dips are hardly used at all now. And just recently, Baroness Hayman, the Minister of Research, actually had all the organophosphate products used for sheep dip recalled off the market. Admittedly, this was only on the basis of that the packaging of the chemical was unsafe. But if that is a way in which the government can get the stuff off the market, then that is brilliant. If that helps them, then let them do it that way. Clearly, the chemical industries have sailed very close to the wind with organophosphates, because the legacy of their use has been so horrendous, not just in the poor sheep dip victims who suffered a whole bizarre array of neurological side effects from using sheep dip, but in the whole BSE saga as well. I mean, the chemical industry have taken themselves very close to the line in the wholesale sale of organophosphates that they put into the food chain in the 70s and the 80s. So I think that in itself is going to mean that they've made a silent retreat. We have won the battle, but it's sadly taken, you know, 2-3 decades of widespread use before we achieved what we wanted to achieve.
The voice of organic farmer Mark Purdy down in Devon, speaking to him at High Barn Farm where he lived, which was set fire to. His telephone lines were cut as it looked like he might be getting into the national press campaigning about organophosphates, and the people doing it were quite clearly being paid by the pesticide industry, specifically by ICI at the time. So anyway, his book, I think, is called Animal Farm, PHARM. What do you make of this whole business of pesticides? We don't talk about it much anymore, but, yeah. You know, they, I was chatting to Georgina Downs, who runs a campaign about spray drift. So this is where you buy a lovely house with a beautiful view over farmland, and then you find in the spring, day after day after day, of tractors coming around spraying this stuff all over them that drifts into your living room and you can hardly breathe.
Yeah, I think you can get really depressed if you think too much about it. But I've been listening to the Mark Purdy interviews, and it's such a shame that he died, because he's an incredible person. And I think there was about 2 weeks ago he was talking, or on your show, he was talking about his philosophy of how people get ill, i.e. that it's, and I don't know, I'm not a scientist, so I have to stress this, but this is, it was so much in line with what I tend to believe, that, yeah, maybe we can get infected with a virus or bacteria, but if our immune system's good, then we can fight it off. And if our immune system's down, and there can be many different factors for that, that's when we're in trouble. And I think that with pesticides, you can't beat them all, but it's about your building up your immune system to try and generally avoiding them. So I have an organic food delivery every week. But yeah, I think pesticides are seriously bad for humans if you have too much of them. But I think we can tolerate, I think our bodies can tolerate a certain amount of them.
Well, the trouble is, I mean, one of the things he's saying is a lot of it accumulates in your body, so you may get MS at an old age, which is caused by pesticides that you've maybe breathed in middle age or when you were younger.
Possibly. And you know what I think is really good for getting rid of pesticides and toxins? Going up to the hills. Because when you start doing exercise, especially if it's in the fresh air, you always find that the first thing that happens is you sweat. So that's getting rid of toxins. The body's really good at that. As long as we move, it's going to help anyway.
Hey, this is Natalie's health show, folks. And I'm going to add something to that as well. Fasting, another good thing to get rid of toxins.
Yeah, I've heard about that.
Yeah, if you... I will say... I mean, because I tend nowadays to fast at Easter just over the week, like Good Friday till Easter Sunday. And you find the first day that you fast, I'm talking about just drinking water, nothing else. And... I suppose it's called a water fast. And you find usually the first day you don't notice it. The second day you get a headache and you're thinking, oh, I'm going to have something to eat. And that, what that is, apparently, is the toxins coming out of your bits of your body and going into your bloodstream. And what happens is, I don't know whether it's your liver or whatever it is then picking those toxins and getting rid of them. Mm-hmm. Kidneys, probably.
That's why they always say that's why when you feel you're seriously ill, you don't want to eat because the body's too busy curing itself. I don't know. It's, the jury's out on it, but I think it's quite possible that that's the case.
So the fast, once you're over the second day, so if we're talking about, say you're fasting on the Friday, Saturday you've got a headache, on the Sunday you feel great.
I'll take your word for it. I haven't done it myself.
So it's the third day if you're ever fasting. You start, and of course, you can potentially go for weeks. I mean, I had a friend who he said he did a 40-day fast. I mean, that's a bit much. That's a Jesus level, you know. I think maybe you've got to fill yourself up a little bit
There's
before
a book
you do that one.
That was written in the 90s. I think it was Lost in the Himalayas. This guy got stuck in winter in the Himalayas and he found a cave and he didn't eat for 40 days. Or he had one Mars bar, I think. So, yeah, but he survived.
Let's talk a little bit about your work in the media, because you were working for Robert Maxwell at The Mirror and also on Jackie. Two very different, I'd imagine. Actually, maybe not. Maybe the tabloid press is a little bit like a kid's
magazine. It was so
magazine.
Different at that time as well, because, Patch's magazine was my first job. Then I was moved to Jackie a few months later, and I used to buy Jackie. I mean, you have to be a certain age to know what it is. It was the teenage girls magazine for years, so I used to go and buy mine. I couldn't believe it when I actually got a job on Jackie. This was my ambition since about the age of 13. And then after that, I went to London and worked on magazines. And at one point, I was a sub-editor, just a freelance sub-editor, but regularly on the Sunday Mirror magazine. And it was the time of Maxwell. And yeah, things were quite strange, because I remember he insisted on having an article in the Sunday Mirror magazine, which was basically a kind of colourful tabloid with all the sort of gossip and things. But he would have this, insist on having this article published in it. I can't remember if it was every issue, but it was such a big, long article that they had to put it in a really small font size just to get it in. It was really quite strange. And his helicopter used to land on the roof of the building regularly. I never met the guy, but...
So what happened to him?
Yeah, we all know what happened to him.
I think he was involved. Obviously, he was the father of Ghislaine Maxwell, who's been in the news recently.
And he was a spy, wasn't he?
I think he was, yeah. He was working very closely with the Israelis.
He actually was. I think it was in the Telegraph or something in the 90s. Was it late 90s he published that story?
What could well have been. But then he disappeared, didn't he? He was on a yacht and he disappeared. Do you know what happened there? What's your theory on that one?
I think there was some dirty business going on. I don't know
Maybe he was saying the wrong things. This is what happens with someone who's wealthy and powerful and involved with these intelligence services. Somebody maybe like Boris Berezovsky, as soon as they start thinking, well, I'm going to blow the lid on this, and they start using those tactics against the wrong people, they end up disappearing for whatever reason, dying, committed suicide or whatever. Well, with Jackie, I mean, you're working on this magazine, which do you think that the attitudes have changed since then? Would you be able to do a magazine like that now? And what were the values of Jackie magazine?
Well, remember, we weren't allowed to publish the word pregnant, for example. So, yeah, things have changed a lot.
Well, I suppose that's the idea. Is when you've got you're talking to young girls who may be below the age of puberty, you don't want to really. But hang on, I mean, because you do need to talk about that a bit, don't you?
Yeah, it was quite strange because we used to have these photo stories, and before that, it was kind of cartoon love stories, and you'd get the romances.
So
with
love without pregnancy.
Oh. Yeah, and they'd be sort of be about this girl who falls in love with this man that she's or a young lad that she's seen. But sometimes you think, well, is it even wise to be talking about a girl just seeing someone? Maybe if it's fine if they know each other, and then they go for a Coke. It's always a Coke.
Encouraging casual relationships.
Oh, right. Kind of. Yeah. But I don't know. I mean, I enjoyed it. I really had a great time on Jackie, and I'm still in touch with the people that I worked with from that time. You know,
so it's gone, its demise. What caused its demise? Just people weren't buying it? Kids weren't buying it?
There were some other magazines that came along that were allowed to mention the word pregnant, like Just 17. And eventually Jackie was seen as maybe, I don't know, it had its time.
And what about your blog you're doing now, The Purposeful Path? Because you're not doing the podcast anymore.
I
first came across you during COVID anyway.
Yes, yes.
I kept thinking I
sort of got life took over. I mean, I really admire people like you and other people who just seem to be very focused and put out material week after week. And I find that very difficult. And I think eventually I thought that the Imagining Freedom podcast, I've done a lot on that. And it's like my documentation of that period. And The Purposeful Path is on Substack. So it's Substack at The Purposeful Path. I just wanted to mention the Better Way conference briefly.
Yeah, of course,
because that's why I'm visiting down the southwest. I'm staying in
Bath.
Oh, you
haven't just come to see us then?
I'm having a great time this weekend, seeing everyone that I've wanted to see for years. So when I walked in to the Better Way conference, the first person that I met was Derek Brose's partner, Miriam.
Right.
And Derek Brose, I don't know how many people
yesterday.
Are aware of him. This
today.
Is today.
Today. Right, okay.
So I'm a great follower of Derek Brose. I really like his attitudes. And the reason I'm mentioning him now, it was really great to meet Miriam. And he's an agorist. I think he's an agorist. He's very interested in sort of agorism, which is the type of anarchism. I'm really not sure. I don't know. I don't have a particular philosophy. But the thing I like about agorism, it's really about a free marketplace, about people exchanging with each other. I get the impression that there's a lot of fear and propaganda. Well, a lot of propaganda has gone into the whole sort of past few years, and it's been building up since before the pandemic. And there's been a lot of propagation of fear and feelings of shame as well. So what I really want to do is to write articles about how people can actually change their situation. So I've written a post about the GM foods in the 1990s, because that was a situation where suddenly we were having GM foods almost imposed on our food, and genetic modification. And a lot of people didn't want it. And a lot of people turned to organic foods. And after a while, the supermarkets started saying that they weren't going to have GM in their own products.
Yeah, that's right. Iceland started it, didn't they?
I think it was not Sainsbury's.
Oh, no, I think it was Iceland was the first one. But anyway, quite a lot of them.
But the fact is, it's
a big part of that was Daily Mail coining this phrase Frankenstein Foods.
Yeah, but in a way, that started, that was in the 1990s. I think it was Friends of the Earth said it at first. But a lot of people, there was a lot of backlash against that. But I mean, it's the fact that people took action just by changing their buying habits. And that led to political action, because remember, Tony Blair was really behind GM foods. There was a huge push for it. And so I'm just meaning that people are more powerful than we think. We are more powerful than we think.
If we know. And of course, what's going on now is a lot of this GM stuff is coming in unlabeled. And there's a lot of, I mean, for example, things like whether food has got pesticides in it is unlabeled. A lot of salads do.
Yeah.
And so there's a big push by the food industry, people like Kraft and the rest of them, or these crafty types, to not label this stuff.
Yeah.
And that means that people just don't know, and they just buy it, and there's no information about it at all.
Yeah, and I think people can bring about change in different ways. So that
you can't.
Is very
This is
sneaky.
My point, is you can't bring about change if you don't know something genetically
modified. Why is that happening only in England, though? It's only in England
that's
and Wales
funny,
and
isn't
not.
It? Well, it's because the lobby finds it a lot easier to do what it wants to do in England. Anyway, we're also joined by Alex Craner. Hi, Alex. First time I've met you. I should shake your hand, I think. Alex, you're also talking at this Better Way conference, aren't you? You've come over from Monaco. You're originally from Croatia. What are you up to over in Bath at the Better Way conference?
Yeah, so I'm an author, and I'm a hedge fund, former hedge fund manager, and I had, you know, one of the subjects discussed at the Better Way conference in Bath, which is organized by the World Council for Health, is the question of the freedom of speech, and I had an early run-in with censorship in the West in 2017, because I wrote and published a book titled The Grand Deception. And it was a book in which I tried to warn about the gathering conflict between Russia and the Western power. And I tried to unmask a very powerful cabal in the West that was pushing us towards that conflict. And the book was banned virtually within 6 weeks from publishing. So,
how was it banned exactly then?
An official from the United States State Department sent a letter to Amazon requesting that the book be banned, and Amazon complied, no questions asked, and the book was disappeared. And nowadays, you know, Amazon is basically a bookseller and a book catalog. So if they delete you, you go invisible.
Well, they did the same with me. I was selling my books and stuff on there, and I just got a letter saying, well, we think that you're a fraud and we're closing your account.
And they did the same to me a few years later in October 21, because I had two other books listed there which were completely uncontroversial. They were about commodities trading and about investment management and risk management, stuff like that. Nothing controversial whatsoever. But, you know, since we're talking about Amazon, you know, they basically didn't pay me any royalties for about 3 years. And then one of my books got an award in 21. And then the royalty some started to become a bit more meaningful. And then I noticed, you know, like my royalty account keeps going down, but I'm not receiving any money. So I said, like, what's up with all this? And it took about 3 months of back and forth emails until somebody finally responded. It's like, oh, yes, indeed, we owe you some money. We'll be wiring you the balance within the next 5 business days. And then literally 3 hours later, I get an email from somebody else at Amazon saying, we think you're a fraud and we're shutting down your account. And by the way, we're keeping the money.
Fantastic. So, yeah, well, they are a fraud, aren't they? I mean, yeah, these enormous operation. People. It is, yeah. And they seem to be much more powerful than individual governments. Martin, you're on the line there. And what an interesting story from Alex. And what he's doing is he's actually put out a book there. He's saying, effectively, these new legislation that's being brought in the West to sanction Russians is a fraud. And his book explains how the whole thing is a fraud. And yet Amazon are just cancelling him, effectively.
Well, there's a definitely creeping totalitarianism going on in the West, is there not? And, you know, if you've got your eyes open, you can see what's going on. They're trying to control the narrative about everything to do with the conflict with the Russian Federation. And, of course, it spills over into lots of other things as well.
So do you want to just say something about this conference then, Alex? Because you're going to be speaking about freedom of speech. What sort of, can you give us, I don't want you, you know, obviously do your speech now, but what's going to be the thrust of it? You know, your book, clearly important, but we've got all sorts of challenges on freedom of speech at the moment. We've just got this thing called BBC Verify, which has popped up. I mean, we've had Mariana Spring and her programme around for a while. They're now saying that they are going to be making decisions and advising the public about what's fake news and what isn't. The only trouble is they are connected, Mariana Spring is connected to this organisation, the Integrity Initiative, Paul Mason and people like this. So they almost look as if they're having a conversation it's MI5 or the intelligence services saying, well, actually, these facts are true and these facts are not. So makes I would have thought, quite a lot for you to talk about what's going on with free speech in Britain.
Well, yeah, that's an enormous lot to talk about. Only I'll have 10 minutes to deliver my remarks, and then we'll have a longer panel after that. It's a mess. I think that the assault on free speech.
Hang on, it's not a mess, is it? Because this is deliberate. The idea is that people who are telling the truth are being shut down.
Yes. Yeah. Well, from that point of view, it is pretty simple. I'm saying it's a mess because it's gathering momentum. The censorship drive has accelerated very markedly. I think about 2 years ago when they realized that their pandemic narrative is falling apart, and now with the war in Ukraine, they are extremely anxious to control the narrative. And they're preparing an all-out assault on free expression to make sure that they can control that narrative. However, you know, I'm happy to share the news that, you know, as somebody who has grown up in communism and who has experienced when the communist regime started to lose control.
So that's in Croatia,
yes? Yeah, that was in Croatia, which was at the time in the 1980s part of former Yugoslavia. I mean, it was discernible that the system was falling in on itself. And obviously the people in power, you know, they had the control of the media, of the police, of the courts, of the military, of the whole state bureaucracy apparatus. They had complete control of the intelligence agencies, but when they started to lose control of the narrative, they lost control. And there was time when you would board a public bus, and they had stickers plastered everywhere. You know, like if you see something, say something, kind of asking people to rat off on each other, to report suspicious activity.
If you see anything suspicious, please tell a member of staff.
Please call this number.
Yeah, or text. They do the same on the London Underground.
Well, no, you couldn't text anybody at the time, but they, you know, that was not 1980s.
Yeah.
But, you know, they asked you basically to report. But the thing is that nothing worked. You know, nothing worked. The tide had turned. And for all their attempts to control the narrative, they lost that battle. And the current lineup is losing the battle as well. And whatever they might try to do, the BBC, this and that, you know, it's not going to work. It's the equivalent of King Canute flogging the waves to try to stem the tide. It's hopeless. And at some point, they should probably concede defeat and cut their losses. But as we know, they won't.
Well, a lot of the ideas around this whole dark enlightenment that my old school friend Nick Land was talking about was he was always into demoralising people. So a lot of the narrative is about making people feel powerless. What you're saying is actually this is a sign of desperation from those at top.
Oh yeah, definitely. This is, you know, back when they were cozy and comfortable in their control of the system and of the, you know, cultural narratives, they were relaxed. You didn't see the chains. You didn't see the censorship. You actually were comfortable enough to believe that you did have freedom of speech. Some people understood that you didn't. It was Joe Strummer who said, number two, you have the right to free speech as long as you're not dumb enough to actually try it.
Ah, right.
So it was discernible for a long time that free speech was a facade and that you could exercise it so long as you stayed within the bounds of permissible discourse. But this has changed now, and the permissible discourse has become so narrow that the bounds are becoming obvious. And I got canceled, you got canceled, many people got canceled, and many people see this. And so now it's undeniable, even to the normiest of the normies, that censorship is real and it's gathering and it's become very real and very ominous. However, as you rightly said, it's not the sign of their strength and power, it's the sign of their desperation because their system is falling in on itself. And there's nothing they can do to reverse that.
Well, I suppose the idea really is that, and one of the major flaws in what's going on at the moment is they seem to have picked this fight with the Russians in Ukraine, but they're also picking a fight with their own people.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, you know,
never fight a war on two fronts at the same time.
My contention, Tony, is that the purpose of the wars abroad is primarily the war at home. Because once you're engaged in a foreign war, then you can sweep a lot of your domestic crises under the carpet and you can justify things. You can tell the people like, oh, you know, the petrol is so expensive because we're at war with the Russians because of the Putin price hike. If you can't have your medical treatment, we're at war. If your pension's gone and your money's losing value, well, you know, blame the Russians. And so on and so forth. And so this is a real effect. And that's why the people in power will escalate wars even past the point when it has become completely obvious and undeniable that they have no chance of prevailing in the actual foreign military conflict.
Well, we're going to be talking a bit more about Ukraine in a minute, but I think before the break, we will do a little bit of a discussion about artificial intelligence. It's been all over the news the last couple of weeks. I was watching the TV this week thinking, good God, this is exactly what it's actually the guy who was at Bilderberg, Eric Schmidt, saying that the humanity faces extinction because of AI that he created. And of course, the idea is that that the people who created it are the best ones to regulate it. So in a way, they've set up their own little self-regulation scheme here. I thought we'd start with a little listen to Yuval Noah Harari. And this is a few years ago where he talks about the people who eat too much. What will we do with them?
In the Industrial Revolution of the 19th century, what humanity basically learned to produce was all kinds of stuff, like textiles and shoes and weapons and vehicles. And this was enough for very few countries that underwent the revolution fast enough to subjugate everybody else. What we're talking about now is like a second Industrial Revolution. But the product this time will not be textiles or machines or vehicles or even weapons. The product this time will be humans themselves. We are basically learning to produce bodies and minds. Bodies and minds are going to be, I think, the two main products of the next wave of all these changes. And if there is a gap between those that know to produce bodies and minds and those that do not, then this is far greater than anything we saw before in history. And this time, if you're not part of the revolution fast enough, then you probably become extinct. Once you know how to produce bodies and brains and minds, so cheap labor in Africa or South Asia or wherever, it simply counts for nothing. Again, I think that the biggest question in economics and politics of the coming decades will be what to do with all these useless people. I don't think we have an economic model for that. My best guess, which is just a guess, is that food will not be a problem. With that kind of technology, you will be able to produce food to feed everybody. The problem is more boredom and what to do with them, and how will they find some sense of meaning in life when they are basically meaningless, worthless. My best guess at present is a combination of drugs and computer games.
So apparently a combination of drugs and computer games are going to occupy everyone's minds, that we're going to end up with loads and loads of useless people because, and he actually uses that phrase, useless people, because their cheap labour, Alex, will not be worth anything anymore.
Well, you know, Harari is free to think whatever he chooses to think, but I think that in any normal world, a person like that would be speaking to his fellow inmates in a loony asylum, not to, you know, to this billionaire club at Davos.
They love his books, don't they? They read his books avidly.
I doubt that they do. Honestly, I doubt that they do. I know many people like this. I can tell you, 90% of the time what they do is they buy books, they set them at their desks, they sit at their desks for months, and then they put them on the shelf.
Yeah.
They never crack it open. And you know, like if you go through their bookshelf, I honestly know people like this, many of them. You go through their bookshelf and it's full of books, and you can tell when a book has been used and read. You know, like it's discolored, it's crumpled, it shows signs of wear. They're all pristine. They never read this stuff. They just assume that they understood what's in it. They kind of go along with the vague notion of the narrative that they're supposed to kind of embrace. And that's that. If you ask them for any details, they have no idea.
Okay, well, the problem is a lot of the bankers are financing this stuff, and they're looking at Harari saying this is the future.
Well, yeah, because, you know, the bankers need to control society for their scheme, which is fraudulent, to work. They need to control society. They need to curb our liberty of movement, our liberty of transactions, our creation, our exchanges, our communications. They need to control everything because their scheme is fraudulent. I mean, no two ways about it. Categorically, it is fraudulent.
Come on, just put a little bit of meat on the bones there.
Why, exactly? I'll try to do it, because all the money that we have in circulation today, and which we are obliged to use, we don't have really the choice of using other types of currencies, is based on a fractional reserve credit creation and fiat currency. So currency in itself has no intrinsic value. So you can collect all of it and it has no value. It only has value in the sense of what you can obtain in exchange for
it. It's almost like an act of faith.
Yes, it is exactly an act of faith. It is based on faith.
A religious.
No, but all currencies are based on faith. Yeah. Some of them have, you know, some intrinsic value, like gold. Gold has intrinsic value, but again, it's faith. It's not that you can eat it. It's not that you can use it for anything. Exactly. It's just that you have faith that you will be able to exchange it for something of value because you know that other people value it and will want to exchange stuff for it. Okay, so now the fact that fractional reserve banking means that you can create credit in excess of the assets that you have in your bank.
So you're just pressing a button and making money out of nowhere. And I suppose,
yes.
So we've got a bit of a battle here,
yeah.
Alex, between people slowly catching up and realizing that the whole thing is a fraud and a fake,
yes.
Between the bankers trying to control society enough so that that doesn't matter when people realize it.
Well, that the people cannot do anything about it, that they're still stuck in the maze. Yeah. And so basically where the fraud comes in is that only the principle of the loans goes into circulation, whereas every loan has to be paid back with interest. So if you put 100 into circulation and you have to repay 200 over the next 10 or 20 years, the other 100 simply doesn't exist. Okay, it's mathematically impossible to repay the principal and interest.
But surely the only way... Hang on, because surely the banks are printing money, so there's extra money kind of coming into the system.
Yeah, exactly. So the only way that you can repay principal and interest is by other people going into debt, putting this money into circulation, and you trying to earn principal and interest and profit to repay everything. But this only works so long as the system is growing. The minute it stops growing, it's no longer stable and it starts to implode on itself. And then what they typically do, what the banking authorities typically do, is that they start printing more and more money to backstop, because, you know, like if you can't pay back your loan, then the your debt on the bank's book starts to become bad debt. And then they start to backstop those losses by printing more money and buying bonds of corporations and giving companies credit, even if the companies are zombies and are not profitable and they can't finance the loans. And they encourage the government to go into spending of any kind, weapons, construction, whatever. And all this until the money begins to lose value in an accelerating way. And then people realize, like, wait a minute, my money is losing value. Maybe we should use a different kind of currency. So people start thinking, like, this is not working out. We need to change something. Well, the bankers don't want you to change something because your debt is their asset. So they only want you to be closed in this matrix and to have no other choice. So they, you know, they are the ones who end up curbing our freedoms and trying to create a totalitarian society. That's where it originates from.
Well, thanks very much for all that. So we're going to have a little look at AI now and what has been going on with that over the... Because I was just gobsmacked, really, this week to see Eric Schmidt coming out and saying, especially after seeing him zipping off at Bilderberg. He is the guy who's kind of taking over from Henry Kissinger. He's the one that it seems like Kissinger wants to take on. And he zipped out from the conference in Lisbon over to Hiroshima, Martin reminded me last week, to the G7 conference, and then back again to see his friends. He was busy, yeah, very busy, weekend before last. And then to see him this week coming out and talking about the AI could lead to human extinction. Here's a report that Al Jazeera did about that this week.
Experts from the top tech companies in the world are issuing a stark warning that the evolution of AI technology could lead to human extinction. The warning was published on the webpage for the Center for AI Technology. Experts, including those from OpenAI and Google DeepMind, say the risk should be made a global priority. But other leading members in the tech industry say the calls are overblown and that mass fear surrounding AI technology is unfounded. While the Center for AI Safety website suggests a number of possible disaster scenarios, artificial intelligence could be weaponized, like being used for building chemical weapons. AI-generated misinformation could destabilize society. The technology be used by government bodies to monitor and censor citizens. Humans could become fully dependent on artificial intelligence. Toby Walsh is the chief scientist at the University of New South Wales AI Institute and the author of the book Machines Behaving Badly, joins us now live from Sydney. Good to have you with us, Mr. Walsh, on the programme. I mean, the tone of the conversation at the moment over AI development seems to be quite alarmist, at the least. I mean, where do you stand about this debate on a pause in development?
I declined to sign that letter and the most recent one. I think there are significant benefits that AI is going to bring. Equally, there are, you know, significant challenges and risks that we need to face up to. But I don't think they're existential. I don't think we have to worry that they're going to destroy humanity. We have faced existential threats, the threat of nuclear war. And unfortunately, that threat has increased. And we see that with posturing going on in Ukraine. That's a very real existential threat that the world faces. But it's not one that AI has really changed.
So that's part of the first part of this interview on Al Jazeera this week about this. I think maybe we'll start with you, Martin Summers, on, you know, he's saying also, first of all, he can't pronounce nuclear. He can't pronounce nuclear, so I'm not sure he knows really what a nuclear war is. But, I mean, of course, this is what we've been being warned about by science fiction for decades, isn't it? That if as soon as you switch over a war to AI, then you better watch out because you've no idea what it's doing. And we know for a fact that the Palantir system, Alex Karp's wonderful little game, is linked up to the US satellites and is being used right now to target Russians in the east of Ukraine.
Well, obviously, I mean, what the Ukraine war is showing is all of this high-tech weaponry being deployed by both sides, very much in advance of anything from the Second World War, for example, changing tactics completely. It's a different battle than it used to be. But, of course, the real problem with AI, from my point of view, is if you remember back to 2000, there was a huge bubble in tech shares because everybody presumed that tech, the introduction of the internet and all of the rest of it was going to massively increase productivity, and that would lead to a boom. So you got all of these, Ponzi schemes developed with nothing real at the bottom of it, you know, like the South Sea bubble. And of course, at a certain point, it became clear. I'll just briefly tell an anecdote about a friend of mine who worked for Bloomsbury Publishing. And because they made loads of money out of Harry Potter, they suddenly decided that, well, we need to kind of get all this high tech in. You know, they didn't have a website, for example. So my friend was given the job, £3 million, develop a website for us, which she did. She then got an award for Website of the Year. And then Nigel Newton, who's the head of Bloomsbury, flew over from New York, said, "I'm great. It's great that you've got this award, but I can't see any profits out of this website." And she had to say to him, "Well, you didn't say to make a profit. You said to make a website." And, of course, that was actually exactly what went wrong with the dot-com bubble. And it burst and collapsed. And probably there should have been a major recession at that point. But just fortuitously, these 19 Muslim terrorists attacked the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. And because of the shock, it was justifiable to pump loads of money into the system to keep it afloat. And AI is not going to be any different from the internet in those days. The problem with capitalism is it develops all these kind of very, very advanced technologies, and then actually it undermines the basis of capitalist prosperity because you actually need a plan to put all this into operation. The market can't do it. They just get bubbles which burst, and then they intervene to deal with the bursts. And I would see that AI as another iteration of that process. It's not going to be able to be viable. I mean, Noval Hariri, they're saying all of these people are going to be thrown out of work. Well, if they're all thrown out of work, they won't be able to buy anything. So that means that they won't be able to. The system depends upon people buying stuff. Otherwise, it doesn't run at all.
Well, surely the whole idea is that these people then become dependent on benefits, isn't it?
Well, no. Well, that's a kind of speculative idea. What will probably happen is we're going to have a major catastrophe in developing countries as the economy collapses. Mm-hmm. It's happening now. You know, the raising of interest rates and the Federal Reserve is making debts unpayable in most developing countries. Michael Hudson is arguing that they should just not pay. But, of course, if they do pay, they're going to drive their societies into civil conflict. So we're staring down the barrel of a gun now.
Well, this is funny that you should say that, but this is what pretty much what Boris Johnson said at the United Nations in 2019. He did an extraordinary, when he was British Prime Minister, extraordinary speech saying that we've got to be really careful about all this stuff. So I thought before we hear from Natalie, let's hear from Boris talking about the dangers of AI at the UN General Assembly in 2019.
Digital authoritarianism is not, alas, the stuff of dystopian fantasy, but of an emerging reality. And the reason I'm giving this speech today with this slightly gloomy proem is that the UK is one of the world's tech leaders, and I believe governments have been simply caught unawares by the unintended consequences of the internet, a scientific breakthrough, far more reaching in its everyday psychological impact than any other invention since Gutenberg. And when you consider how long it took for books to come into widespread circulation, the arrival of the internet is far bigger than print, it's bigger than the atomic age, but it's like nuclear power in that it's capable of both good and harm, and of course it's not alone. As new technologies seem to race towards us from the far horizon, we strain our eyes as they come to make out whether they are for good or bad, friends or foes. AI, what will it mean? Helpful robots washing and caring for an aging population, or pink-eyed Terminator sent back from the future to cull the human race? What will synthetic biology stand for? Restoring our livers and our eyes with miracle regeneration of the tissues, like some fantastic hangover cure? Or will it bring terrifying limbless chickens to our tables? Will nanotechnology help us to beat disease, or will it leave tiny robots to replicate in the crevices of our souls? It is a trope as old as literature that any scientific advance is punished by the gods. When Prometheus brought fire to mankind in a tube of fennel, as you may remember, with his brother Epimetheus, Zeus punished him by chaining him to a Tartarian crag while his liver was pecked out. I talked about a hangover cure. His liver was pecked out by an eagle, and every time his liver regrew, the eagle came back and pecked it again. And this went on forever. A bit like the experience of Brexit in the UK. If some of our parliamentarians had their way.
Well, that's Boris Johnson. We're all tittering in the studio there about Brexit. But it's actually, you know, Brexit, of course, is really not happening. It's not happened. It supposedly happened, but it hasn't. But in a way, Natalie, that wasn't fair to play that, because it was a sort of curveball look at AI. But, I mean, I think it's a sort of speech which would have actually stirred people up a little bit at the UN, because most of those UN speeches, apart from that one done by Colonel Gaddafi years ago, were a pretty boring and pretty moribund. But anyway, so what do you make of this debate over artificial intelligence? Is it something to be really worried about? Because the thing that bothers me is it seems that the people who are going to regulate it are the people that designed it in the first place.
Yes, I mean, it's either going to be something that reinforces their kind of stereotypes. I think this has been raised before. So if the people who designed it have kind of racial stereotyped ideas, then that's going to be reinforced potentially. But other people say that it'll get smarter and smarter as it goes on. It'll learn how to almost program itself. And if that's the case, I just think that it might start figuring out what's really going on. It might start, for example, scanning all the documents about Bilderberg and thinking, hold on a minute, all the people on this that go to Bilderberg end up in powerful positions. Who knows what it might find out?
Yeah, so how is it, where do you stand on this sort of spectrum of dangerous or not dangerous?
Really don't know. I think with any technology, it can be used for good and evil. I suppose Boris Johnson even figured that one out. So it's, I definitely don't think it can become sentient. It can't have emotions, things like that. But it could be dangerous in many ways. I mean, it could be used in war, for example, or it could be used to break into people's homes. There's so many evil potentially malevolent sort of uses of it, so I just don't
I would know. Imagine actually that's exactly the sort of thing that the National Security Agency do and GCHQ do, is they do design little bots to get into your house. So for example, through your smart meter or your Wi-Fi, they're getting into your cooker, you know, they're getting into your washing machine, they're getting it obviously into your laptop. That sort of thing is happening now. What do you make of this this alarm alarm bell that's been rung by Eric Schmidt this week?
I'm kind of agreeing with what Martin said, and also Natalie. I first of all, it's never going to be sentient. I can be categorical about this. I've spent a good chunk of my life in AI development, and I did develop a system that's kind of an early version of AI 20 years ago. what you get out of that is that you've had to deconstruct something down to its ones and zeros, and what you understand is that computers are very powerful and they are they can be very useful, but they only do what you program them to do, and the software code has to be extremely specific. Computers don't know anything about anything. You have to program every last thing about what they're supposed to do into it, into the code.
A lot of this is a sort of sales pitch, is that what you're saying?
Sorry?
It's a kind of sales pitch. They're saying, it can do all these sorts of things.
Yeah,
but
it's
actually,
hype. It's hype. It's hype. It's supposed to, I don't know if it's supposed to make us think that resistance is futile because it's, you know, this is something great and irreversible. But, you know, as this example of the dot-com boom, there was also in late 1990s, there was they were decoding human genome, right? And there was this company, Celera Genomics, and they completely decoded the human genome by something like 1999. And it was a huge deal of hype about this, what that's going to do and how, you know, they're going to, you know, genetically modify this and that and produce, you know, person-specific customized medicines, root out the chronic diseases and all these wonderful things. And Celera Genomics was trading at something like $65 a share, something. And then after they were finished decoding the human genome, it all crashed because they understood finally that it wasn't good for pretty much anything. And then within 2 or 3 years, the stock was trading at 15 cents per share. And, you know, the Craig Venter, the Eric Schmidt of Celera Genomics, he was kind of funny. So he said, like, yeah, I became a millionaire the hard way. I went from a billion and worked my way down to a few million. And so these, you know, like the our capital markets thrive on these stories where some good technologies develop, and then they extrapolate it, you know, like linear into the future where it's all powerful, it changes everything. And they drive this hype because I suppose it drives investment and capital allocations and makes some people extremely wealthy and powerful.
I mean,
for a while.
We had a chat to you, didn't we, last year, maybe the year before as well, about Theranos and Elizabeth.
Oh, yeah, that's another example.
What was her name?
Elizabeth Holmes.
Holmes, that's right, who's now in jail, apparently.
Who's now in jail.
And then today on the BBC, as if that never happened, and all channels across the media today, multi-cancer blood tests will help save thousands of lives by speeding up diagnosis. A simple blood test for cancer is being trialled by the NHS and could, very important word, could maybe, which I added in, speed up diagnosis. Data suggests the Galeri test correctly revealed 2 out of every 3 cancers amongst more than 6,000 people in England and Wales who had visited their GP with suspected symptoms. So it's a similar kind of thing to Theranos here, isn't it? They're saying, here's an amazing bit of technology.
Yeah.
And in a way, I'm sitting here thinking, well, actually, maybe this technology is mostly rubbish. And all they're trying to do is make a buck and sell some product here and get people to invest in it. I mean, you as someone who is a, I suppose that you would be the kind of person they'd be targeting when you were doing hedge funds to invest
in this stuff. Well, back in the day, yes. And I've sat through many, many presentations of amazing medical technologies. It started to, you know, I started to find a definite pattern of, you know, like you would have a presentation by people who invented some kind of a medical treatment or medicine, a pill, a cream, a treatment, whatever, and they would show their results, and they were real. You know, these people are real researchers. But then once it comes into the capital markets, it's no longer about the medicine, about the treatment, about the effect on treating people, the outcomes. It becomes about making money. And so now they're telling you, okay, well, you know, in Europe we can deploy this in this way, and the United States, because it's different with insurance and blah, 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 it can be done in this way. And the whole story about this helping people alleviate some medical condition completely falls out of the equation, and the whole strategy is how to maximize market penetration, because what they want to do is sell it to Pfizer or Merck or whoever, one of the big handful of pharmaceutical companies. And this happens to everything. And sometimes these companies buy the new treatment, not because they want to bring it to the people who need it, but because they already have a product and this thing's going to compete with it. So they just buy it to kind of throw it in the trash and continue selling what they already have and where they have sunk capital.
Fascinating. Well, that's a great way to run a health service, is not? What do you make of the British National Health Service? Some people criticise it, some not. The idea of having a state run, it's a bit socialist, a bit Yugoslavian, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but, you know, I wouldn't even use that label. Why? It's meant to help people get help with their health issues. That's all it's meant to do. It should be a public service. What's the problem with that? And if it's a single payer state controlled system, then the state can negotiate with the providers of health services on behalf of their constituents for the best outcome for the constituents, rather than leaving it to the private business to maximize profit. And the hell with the people who need help and treatments, because once you put it, once you calibrate it for money making, then they don't even have any incentive of making you better. They have the incentive of keeping you sick, so you spend more money.
Well, we've now got a bit of a problem with the National Health Service. Average across the country, 1 in 10 people is now waiting for an NHS operation. So it's not really working very well. And, of course, this is forcing a lot of people to go to private healthcare instead. So COVID and the Conservatives, mainly the Conservatives, I would suggest, have been responsible for really destroying something that many Tories over the years have been, not least of which is Oliver Letwin, have been trying to get rid of for decades. But look, before we finish our... This is our final clip on AI, because it just seemed... I was absolutely gobsmacked to see the extent to which all these companies at Bilderberg, your Palantirs, your OpenAI and the rest of them, and your Google DeepMinds, seem to have this amazing ability to pick on topics which then get promulgated all around. That people don't understand the Chatham House rules. A lot of people don't. Certainly the people on the Patrick Henningsen discussion didn't seem to last week. The idea is you can talk as much as you want about what's discussed in there. You're just not allowed to name the person you heard it from. That's really it. You know, but you know that these things do. After the Bilderberg conferences, you see them all over the press, quite often the topics that were covered in there, and often saying the same sort of things as the people in there are on the record of saying anyway. So you don't need to be a genius to work out what they're talking about. So anyway, this is Baroness Claire Fox here talking about this week, and she's in the House of Lords talking about, oh dear, the AI they created. Oh dear, what have we done?
Front page of Daily Mail, AI could wipe out humanity. The threat as bad as nuclear war must be tackled. I mean, I find myself completely unmoved by these, you know, calls for, you know, Armageddon to kind of approach and AI pioneers fear extinction. I mean, these are the geeks that invented it, and now they're saying they're a bit worried about what they've done.
Well, there's two aspects to it. I mean, one, we've just talked about lockdown. I mean, we've got to be careful about, you know, when people start talking about existential threats, things wiping out humanity, because... In my view, we've heard that rather a lot recently, haven't we? Because it was COVID, it's climate change, it's, you know, anything that moves can be a threat. But of course, every new, by the way, technological breakthrough, from motor car to planes to modern medicine, can be a major threat. But the crisis that's been talked about, the scaremongering language, indicates that what's happened is we've lost faith actually in humanity to deal with the pros and cons of a situation. Of course, artificial intelligence is a real challenge. It's completely different. We're all, you know, we're all looking at it and thinking, wow, this could mean that every, you know, kid at school cheats, we'll never know, deep fakes, will we ever know who a real person is? But actually, We've created artificial intelligence.
Yeah. Well, that's what worries me more about this than anything else, because normally speaking, all of those things you mentioned, aeroplanes, cars, you know, machinery, that was all going to wipe out the workforce. And it was the Luddites, famously, who were the ones who were kind of standing in the way of change, saying, oh, we don't want that. That would be terrible. These people are the ones who invented it. So they're actually kind of trying to make us feel that what they've invented is even more important than they said it was.
Well, first of all, I mean, as you've indicated, exactly the point is, it's not all of the inventors, but I think that what they're saying is, we don't trust you, the public,
right,
handle this well. We're the clever ones who invented it, but now that it's becoming popular, well, of course, that's a bit like the cinema, you know, or any of these things. It's like, you know, it's like reading, in fact. You know, it was fine when only a few people could do it, but as soon as the masses did it, oh my God, it's going to be a dangerous weapon, right, it's going to lead to the end of the world.
Yeah.
But it's also the case that I sat during a Lord's debate on the online safety bill, which is a great, if you want an existential threat, that's it, because it's going to really have a big impact on free speech. And they were talking about artificial intelligence in one of the amendments. And I was just, I had a speech prepared all about saying we need balance and we have to remember the positive sides and not be negative. And before I got to speak, there was about 10 contributions that described in graphic detail the uses of AI when it came to pornography,
right,
and the deep fake use of pornography, pornographic images and avatars and so on, in relation to children. And I thought, what a grim use of imagination and curiosity that the only thing that you've come up with is this terrible use of AI. Well, everything can be used terribly, but I wanted to counter that and still want to counter it with that brilliant story of the man who has been paralyzed and through the use of artificial intelligence can now walk, just by thinking about it, because of artificial intelligence. We've got to see that this is a tool and how we use it is up to us, but to make it seem as though it's kind of out there beyond our control, as I say, has a dim view of human beings, and I don't share that dim view.
No.
We have to make sure it's a good thing.
Yeah, I think so. And I think we ought to be more sort of confident in our own ability to change and to adapt and to deal with it. And I think you're absolutely right. Claire, great to see you. Thank you very much indeed. Claire Fox, Director of the Academy of Ideas, author, of course, as well. I Find That Offensive is the book. And you can find her in the House of Lords. Sometimes being offensive, sometimes not. This is the way we are.
So Baroness Claire Fox speaking on Mike Graham's programme on Talk Radio this week. Maybe you first on this, Alex. What she's saying there, I suppose, is similar to what you're saying. But, I mean, what she's saying is that the people, and both of them actually, are saying that the people who are creating this are wanting to control the outcome of it. It may simply be, I'm put this to you, that they're so concerned about the way their AI is being used in Ukraine that they feel a bit vulnerable to the way this is going to be used in the world media against them. And so they're trying to get their, you know, defence in before that happens. Because it is quite a horrific thing to do, to switch a computer on, a chess computer on, say, beat the Russians, and here's a load of missiles and satellites.
I don't know about use of AI in Ukraine, whether it's real, whether it's effective, whether it's extensive, but there is something that emerged from AI, which is what I think is more likely a threat that they perceive, and that is that, you know, AI is not very good at lying, because lying is actually a very complex thing. It has to, you know, like, you have the universe of information, which, you know, is it's flat. It's not, you know, it may be wrong, but it's not lies, right? It may be distorted. Now, out of this universe of information, you can construct narratives, but to construct false narratives, there has to be an objective, right? So when, you know, like, when people lie, they lie for a reason. There's like a cause that determines how you're going to form a narrative from information that's available, right? Well, AI is not good at that, because you would have to explicitly program that objective of the deception into how it's going to construct a story. And that became very obvious when somebody asked, I think, ChatGPT to write like a, I don't know, like a 3,000-word essay about Ukraine, and ChatGPT put together a truthful account. And the truthful account was favorable to Russia. You know, like, it said that, like, the new Ukraine regime was brought to power through a U.S. orchestrated coup, and that they, you know, like, built up Ukrainian military in order to use Ukraine as a bludgeon to destabilize Russia, the regime change it, and partition, blah, blah, blah. It laid all that down. And now, because all that information is in your information universe, it's available to these bots that, you know, like, sift through information, and that's how it constructed the story. Now, if you wanted to make it lie, it would actually be very complex to train a bot to lie in a way that you want it to lie, because you can lie in so many ways that don't serve.
Maybe they can go to politician school. AI should go to, because I mean, it does seem to me that a lot of politicians are simply trained, paid liars. A lot of them have to kind of buy into a certain way of looking at things, and depending on how good they are at it, that's whether they get hired or not.
Yeah, but they always know why they're lying. You know, that's almost a given. That's the foundation on which they weave their deception. But the AI doesn't know that. It only knows information, and, you know, it follows the orders that you give it. So you say, tell me about climate change, it's going to tell you about climate change.
Maybe we should be pleased if AI journalists take over.
Well, I don't know, because, you know, AI is good at certain things, but it's not good at complex and subtle things.
It's not very good at writing articles. If you say, they're quite good at sports articles. You can see some of those that have been written allegedly by AI, and there's a lot of money by Google going into, for example, the Press Association and other organisations, which they're trying to get the AI to write these articles for them. But anyway, I said we were going to stop talking about that. We're going to get stuck into some more prosaic. Like, for example, another attack with several drones on Moscow this week.
Well, let's now speak to journalist Yulia Shapovalova in Moscow. Yulia, we've been seeing these cordons set up and police on the streets there. What more do we know at this stage?
It's been the most massive attack on Moscow and the Moscow region since the beginning of the so-called special military operation in Ukraine. And now we've received official information from Russia's Ministry of Defense. They called the UAV attacks an act of terror committed by the Kiev regime. 8 aircraft type unmanned aerial vehicles were involved in that attack. All of the enemy drones were destroyed by air defense forces. That's according to the Ministry of Defense. So we understand that the drones attacked the western and southwestern parts of Moscow and the Moscow region. 3 UAVs crashed into residential buildings. One of the drones had been carrying explosive devices that actually did not detonate. According to Moscow Mayor Sobyanin, 2 people asked for medical help after the fall of one of the UAVs in Moscow. Police, emergency services and several ambulance teams continue to work at the crash sites in Moscow, and the residents of one of the blocks of flats in the southwestern part of Moscow have been evacuated, and the territory around their apartment block has been cordoned off. And there are also reports that another woman has been injured in the Moscow region, while authorities say that basically the city is functioning as usual.
Well, certainly no panic amongst Moscovites. But what do you make of this, Martin? We've had several of these attacks now, and they seem to be getting a bit bigger. The idea is, of course, the long-range missiles in Ukraine can't reach Moscow, but the drones can somehow. So what do you make of this?
Well, obviously, we've got limited information on all of this, but I understand that the British intelligence services have created stay-behind networks inside Russia, which are probably launching these drones from within the city limits in Moscow. I think they're doing all of this stuff to draw attention from the fact that they've lost Artemyovsk, which used to be called Bakhmut, and also that they can't really mobilize the so-called counteroffensive. So the Western powers and their Ukrainian allies are in the business of creating events and narratives to disguise the reality of the fact that on the ground in the eastern Ukraine, the war is effectively lost. but they don't want to admit it, as Alex pointed out earlier.
So, Natalie, what do you make of this? What's going on in Ukraine? What are your thoughts about it?
Funnily enough, I phoned in to the Richie Allen show in 2014 because I was so really concerned about what was going on in Ukraine, and I was saying that I was, you know, it was a really dangerous. They were playing with fire, and it was all about. It is a kind of colonialism, really. It's all about these two powers, and it's like Ukraine is in between these two powers, and it has a lot of natural produce, a lot of, you know, it's a very rich country, really. It's a very dangerous game that they're playing.
Well, it certainly seems to be, and it may be simply that it's an almost impossible narrative to control now. They're kind of almost.
And it's
that's
like
why
a buffer state, isn't it? And it worries me that it could just go on and on and on, a bit like Nepal between China and India.
Yeah, there's the great spring offensive by the Ukrainians. Well, it just didn't materialise. Mm-hmm. So what are you going to say now? And it quite clearly, Alex, not a winnable war, is it?
Well, no, I don't think it is. And I think that it's created a tremendous strain in the leadership of Ukraine, because it's very clear that the spring counteroffensive that the West wants and that they have been preparing for is something that the Ukrainians themselves are extremely reluctant to do, because even at the most optimistic projections, they could score some very modest gains that they would be unable to sustain for a very long time. So it would be only a temporary gain. And it's completely well understood that it would be at a huge cost in personnel and in casualties. So they simply don't want to do it. And the West's insistence that they do go ahead with this counteroffensive is what has led to the disappearance of Supreme Commander of Ukrainian forces, General Valery Zaluzhny, and the head of the ground forces, Alexander Sirsky. They've just vanished. And they vanished, I think, no later than 7th May, so it's been close to a month. We've had very contradictory stories and information about his whereabouts, whether he's even alive or not. I think there's even a chance that he could be in Russia negotiating Ukraine's future. The reason why I think that, and it's completely speculative on my part, is because we really don't know where he is. And then there was that really, really bizarre attack from Ukraine into Russia on the 22nd of May, which was so bizarre that all we know about it is disinformation for both sides. And the pictures that the Russians provided about it, to me, looked like a movie set, because I mean, we've seen now hundreds, if not thousands, of photographs of real, actual aftermath of the conflict, and these photographs look nothing like it. And so I wonder, because it was a large attack, there were several helicopters involved, many armored personnel carriers. There was obviously a lot of people who crossed over from Ukraine into Russia. We don't know who these people are, and we don't know where they ended up. Supposedly they've been all killed or dispersed or retreated, but it's very unclear. And I wonder if it wasn't simply after Chinese intervention, and maybe under Chinese guarantees, that they simply used this incursion as a way to ditch the scene and to talk to Russians and to talk peace. And maybe we'll find out about it. Again, I'm speculating, but really everything that we do know about it is just disinformation.
We've got a big meeting coming up next month in Riga. Do you think it's going to be feasible? There's a lot of people talking, including our own Prime Minister, about managing to change the charter of NATO to allow Ukraine to join. Now, that would seem to me to imply the beginning of World War III. If NATO is part of, if Ukraine is part of NATO, then we'll be at war with the Russians at that point.
Well, sure, yeah. You just have to persuade 30 other NATO member countries to go along with it. And, you know, I can tell you already that Hungary is not going to go along with it. Croatia is probably not going to go along with it. Slovakia, Bulgaria, Romania, it's going to be, you know, wishful thinking.
Turkey, we've just had Erdogan brought back in Turkey. I mean, they're right stuck in the middle, aren't they, really? Amazing that they're in NATO still, in a way. They almost seem to me to be the Russians' spies in the NATO meeting.
They're the only strong, actually strong, powerful military in all of NATO. Turkey is Europe's biggest and strongest army. So if you let Turkey go out of NATO, then all you have is a collection of paper tigers that don't convince anyone, that they cannot convince themselves even anymore.
So it's almost as if the NATO leaders and the politicians that are employed because they say what they're told to say are running out of rope, really, because it's almost impossible for them to... They're offering all these promises to the British public through the press and to the Ukrainian people, but none of them really are going anywhere.
Yeah, and I think that's entirely normal, because the last thing they're going to accept is defeat. This is like Hitler in the very last days of World War II barking out orders, thinking that there's a chain of command that's going to obey him, and people were everybody already knew that the game was lost. So we're there, you know, like people who get media exposure and people who talk to the public, they're never going to say like, yeah, you know, we messed up, it's time to concede defeat and cut our losses. They're just going to fantasize about, you know, anything to try to preserve the illusion of control and the likelihood of them prevailing. But that's not happening.
Anybody that calls them out, Mariana Spring and BBC Verify will be set on them in order to... Well, I don't know. It seems to me that whole business... I think what I'll do is I'll put a link to on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to the emails from Paul Mason implicating Mariana Spring in this whole integrity initiative, intelligence initiative, which is what we call it. So I'll put that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Also have to mention the arrest of Kit Clarenberg from the Grey Zone this week. I mean, that's...
You mean detention?
Arrest?
I thought he was just detained.
He was just briefly detained for questioning.
Briefly, 5 hours.
So what do you make of that, Alex?
Well, it's, you know, clearly they're desperate to control the narrative, and Kit Clarenberg has been absolutely superb. I think he's one of the up and coming journalists, you know, of good caliber, and you know, clearly they want to intimidate him.
Extended interrogation about his political views.
Yes, they took his credit cards. I don't know what they did. I guess they copied them or something. His devices. They kept him for 5 hours. They said that he had no right to refuse to answer even a single question that they asked him, else he would be arrested. And they held him there for 5 hours. Well, you know, it's clear heavy-handed intimidation, which, you know, everybody would scoff if the story came from Russia or North Korea or from China.
Right now, Natalie, so at one point the interrogators demanded to know whether the Grey Zone had a special arrangement with Russia's Federal Security Bureau, FSB, to publish hacked material. Now, I don't know why they have to detain him to ask that. Why can't they just phone them up or go round to the Grey Zone and ask? Do you think that because the guy's under detention that he's more likely to tell them?
Well, I don't know, but how easy it is to like lay out these allegations. You know, you can just say, "Oh, he's a spy. He's working for the Russians."
So, what this was really about was actually a phishing operation, because they seized all of his electronic devices and SD cards, fingerprinted him, took DNA swabs, photographed him intensively, and they threatened to arrest him if he did not comply. So, this is what do you think is the significance of the Grey Zone as a publication? It seems to me that they're barking up the right tree.
Well, you know, they're barking up the right tree in the sense that Grey Zone is really good quality journalism that is challenging the official narrative. And they are now desperate to control the narrative, which is getting harder and harder. So the people who are effectively challenging them need to be intimidated into self-censorship or into, you know... I don't know, giving up or staying silent. And I think that this is the whole objective of it, because you're right, if they really thought that he was some kind of a Russian collaborator or spy, they could have really just arrested him.
Well, one of the best people done the reporting on Mariana Spring and BBC Verify, they pointed out that BBC Verify is managing bogus personalities on social networks in the manner of the British Army's 77th Brigade or the Pentagon's Operation Earnest Voice. Mariana Spring's history of churning out disinformation in the service of the British government objectives adds a whole new level of concern about the initiative. They're talking about how she appears to not have any kind of back career in journalism, and yet now she's been put in this very important job. The British government responded almost immediately by psychologically bludgeoning its population into compliance with harsh lockdown measures. So they're looking at the way that the BBC was used during the COVID plandemic. And so I'll put a link up to this. It's, I think, a fascinating analysis, really, of why it is that maybe the Grey Zone is doing its job. It's saying, well, hang on a minute. Here is a so-called fact-checking organisation. We'll be talking a bit more about that next week. We've got Judith Brown coming in, who's just done a whole report on fact-checking organisations and who's funding them. And they're being caught out by people like the Grey Zone, Alex.
Yeah, correct. I think it's all a struggle to retain control. And
well done to Kit Clarenberg anyway for doing articles excellent enough and scary enough for the disinformation campaigners to get himself arrested. Anyway, listen, we're coming towards the end. It's only 10 to 8 now. And I want to get in a little bit about COVID and that kind of thing, because you're off to a health conference, which is largely sparked by all this. And I spoke earlier this week to Jackie Devoy. We'll be hearing from her in a minute, who's done a whole film about midazolam and the way that was used, called A Good Death. But I'd like to start, because we mentioned him last week briefly, Dr. Rashid Buttar, who sadly died a couple of weeks ago. And here he is talking in his last interview, as I promised I'd try and dig out last week. And he has all sorts of interesting things to say. And it includes this, a little clip of some of his interviews that he was doing during the pandemic.
YouTube did try to assassinate me. It was like a character assassination. So we had 89 videos that had hit a million or more views within the first 12 hours of being released that they took down. And then they finally took my channel down. I had millions of followers. I had two different times, once in June of 2020 and then again in September or October of 2020, where I had no subscribers on my YouTube channel for literally 2 to 3 months. And then unbelievably, in 48 hours, I have 84,000 new subscribers. And then that happened again in October, had 73,000 new subscribers in literally 24 hours. First time it was 48 hours, second time it was 24 hours. But it was like somebody was blocking the block button and then forgot to block it in those 2 days. And, you know, it was massive. So it wasn't that I disappeared. It was that they took my voice away and Facebook followed, you know, shortly after that. The only social media platform that didn't take me down was Twitter, and I had 90-some thousand subscribers on there, and, you know, it was my smallest platform by far. I think the next smallest one was Instagram, and we had like 400,000 on there. So they basically took me down to stop the voice. And here's what was interesting. I did a video with Dr. Bruce Lipton and Nia Peoples, who used to be the star from a show called Fame and Ranger Walker, Texas Ranger. And so this video that the three of us did was on a subject called love and gratitude. We didn't talk about politics. We didn't talk about cancer. We didn't talk about autism. We didn't talk about vaccinations. We didn't talk about COVID. We didn't talk about Trump. We didn't talk about anything that could be construed as controversial. All we talked about was love and gratitude and sending that to somebody else on the other side of the planet. That's all we did. That video hit 1.87 million views in the first 12 hours on YouTube. Wow. And YouTube took that video down. And Dr. Lipton's wife texted me. She said, why would they take a video like that down? It doesn't make any sense. You guys didn't say anything. And that's when I realized what they fear. It's not the information that we're putting out. It's what they fear is people becoming empowered, because once they become empowered, they can no longer control us. They can no longer victimize anyone. They can no longer take advantage of you. So they don't want people to realize and discover their power. And so that's why the censorship has been so rampant. And, you know, I didn't know what your show was about, but it was interesting that you started off and you talked a little bit about your political beliefs. And then you also read a passage from the Bible. And you obviously saw that my second major was theology. So yeah. I'm going to go into an area that I don't normally talk about. But I want to show you something, too, in a video that I think your producer has pulled up. But okay. I had a journey that took place in December, on December 12th. It was recorded, and it was one of those experiences that I would have I think I labeled it the most unexpected encounter that I would have ever expected. And I have a very strong belief in the Creator. I choose not to follow a religion anymore because I've studied too much about religion and theology. But I can tell you that my experience on December 12th, which is a 2.5 hour recording of my encounter with the Creator, basically told me that it was now time for people to be reminded that they must exercise free will. And so this video, JT, if we can play that, that'd be great. I appreciate that.
We're done. The chimeric research, despite having a moratorium by the U.S. government to prevent any chimeric research basically means that they're taking a naturally occurring substance or virus, in this case, and then mutating it, genetically modifying it, changing the configuration morphologically to gain function. It's called a gain of function study or gain of function research. And that basically means that they're making something that already may have some potential to cause harm,
this particular
making
video.
It more harmful, making it more virulent, making it more resistant. And basically that's what I found, that they took the SHC014 strain of coronavirus, the surface antigen component, and brought in the backbone from the SARS coronavirus, put them together, and then inserted HIV and MERS orthologs on top of it to make a more virulent, more detrimental virus.
What I think you're talking about is the moratorium that was placed, and then $3.7 million from the National Institute of Health was transferred to China so they could continue this research, even though the moratorium, so they basically outsourced this research to China. Is this the same topic we're talking about here? This news is just breaking?
So it goes back to 2014. The U.S. government decided, based upon certain virologists at that time, saying that, look, there's no justification for this kind of research. There's a potential for it to cause harm, cause a pandemic. So there's no justification for us to do this type of research. So the government passed a moratorium in 2014. Fauci approved monies to be a section for this type of research. He created this entire casket that we're seeing with the world shutdown was created by this initial aspect back in 2015. He broke the law. He went against government moratoriums. He took taxpayer money and he funded research that has now led to the COVID-19. Fauci, in 2017, he was documented at Georgetown University saying that there will be a pandemic that this presidency will face, that this term will face. How did he know that in 2017 that something was going to happen in 2018,
19, or 2020? So that's Dr. Rashid Buttar, rest in peace, just speaking a few weeks ago on the last interview he did. But actually that last section there was a series of videos that he'd done during the pandemic. I mean, Natalie, we do sort of sometimes forget that Fauci in 2017 at Georgetown University said there will be a pandemic during this presidency. I mean, you know, there's little factoids that come out through this whole business that make you rather smell a rat.
Yeah,
I mean, they do me anyway.
Definitely. A good AI whatever could definitely put the pieces together, I think. It's not some sort of wacko conspiracy theory. It's actually, you could do the research and, yeah, people were seeing it coming. But I think that a lot of people just don't want to look at that. I think it's too scary for many people. They'd rather just turn their eyes away from it.
What's for you, any particular lesson from the whole experience of the last few years and the whole COVID business? Anything, you know, you've sort of thought, well, actually, that's, where we live and learn. So what have you picked up from it all?
I think one thing is that people were primed. There's been so much propaganda. There was so much propaganda during the pandemic 2020, 2021. But before that, for the years before that, people did, there was a sense of shame built up and people were saying, you know, we are the virus. Humans are the virus. People were expecting some big crisis because we'd been bad humans and we had done this to the earth and we'd done that to the earth. A lot of the things that we were blaming, or ordinary people were blaming themselves for, was due to huge forces, you know, mining or industrial forces. But people were blaming themselves and expecting a big disaster. So when the news happened that there was this disease, a lot of people got really depressed and thought, this is it. I could see that in some people's faces and what they were saying.
Okay, Martin Summers, what do you make of Rashid Buttar? Certainly, it was fascinating actually visiting Charlie Skelton, having a good chat with him over at the Bilderberg, because he said to me at one point, he said, well, what do you think was really, you know, where did this COVID really come from? I gave him my, as we talk about regularly on this show, he said, well, he's not a regular, and of course he's not. And he said, well, that's pretty much, yep, I think you probably, that's exactly what I think, pretty much. And I think it's, if you're spending your time really paying attention to this, you do, I think, align up with this, the Fauci-funded Wuhan program, gain of function, Peter Daszak, the rest of them. And this is just something which was farmed over to the Chinese because the Pentagon couldn't do it in the United States. But anyway, what do you make of Rashid Buttar there, Martin? He's actually was on the case pretty much from word go. It was amazing. Even in April, May 2020, there he is. He's pretty much got it.
Well, as regular listeners to the show will know, I'm pretty much convinced that it was a bioengineered virus, and deliberately so. It didn't leak by accident in Wuhan. It's part of a war-fighting strategy by the US deep state. And another big, very early piece of factoid, if you like, for me, was when the Times of Israel told its readers, and it was confirmed on Israeli television, that the Israeli Defense Forces were given a heads-up in November 2019 that there was going to be a pandemic coming from China. Now, that's basic information. That means that the Defense Intelligence Agency of the United States knew that there was something was going to happen. How did they know? It's because they're the major suspects. As Kirillov, who's the head of the Russian biological and chemical warfare troops, has been saying. And in actual fact, in the rest of the world, it's pretty clear what this is all about. And of course, all of the disruption and lockdowns and so on are a method of social control within the West. But of course, those who were saying that there was no virus and that there was nothing to worry about are missing the point, because this is basically warfare. Millions are dead. It's not a deadly virus. You don't want something that kills everybody. You want something that stops the Chinese economy in its tracks, and in that it succeeded. And of course, that's the point of all of this. This is World War III. The plandemic, which I'm quite happy to call it, is part of that World War III war-fighting strategy by the deep state in the West.
Well, hang on, because it's all blown back straight in the Americans' faces, surely. That's the major flaw.
The deep state doesn't care about the ordinary people in the West. They want to control them. So they use this as an opportunity to bring in all of these measures to control people, that we're all familiar with. And that's not a blowback. That's actually part of what they wanted to happen. What they didn't expect to happen was that the Chinese would effectively deal with it. And it's their economy which came out of recession first, because they dealt with it effectively. because they're fighting a war.
Well, I noticed one of the most fascinating things about, you know, I'd love to hear what Alex makes of this, was where that many of the lockdowns that were taking place very late in China seemed to actually be just an excuse not to export anything as part of an economic war. Anyway, Alex, what do you make of what Rashid Buttar is saying there and his passing? He's obviously quite a major contributor to understanding what was really going on, a very courageous doctor, actually a British-born, although he's practising in the United States. And what do you... What have you taken from the last few years?
Well, I think that Rashid Buttar has been one of the very first doctors who came out openly to debunk the pandemic narrative. And I remember that because, you know, I was seeking out voices like his, because I was convinced from day one that the pandemic was a hoax. And the reason why is because they've been doing these things for about 20 years now. You know, we had SARS, MERS, Zika, you know, just like every few years there was a different one, and it was always strange. And I actually looked kind of deeply into the Zika thing, and I realized that the narrative was completely fake. And then there was that other thing in Mexico, when the swine flu in Mexico, which was completely a hoax. And so when they announced COVID-19, I thought, like, there goes another one. And then, you know, like when they locked down the schools, which, you know, like, I'm 53 years old, I've never seen that. My parents have never seen that. You know, like, this is completely different. And I knew that they crossed the Rubicon. There was no way back, and they would have to go all the way with it. However, you know, gloom and doom aside, we have to acknowledge that we are actually back in the old normal, even though the powers that be were adamant that we were not going back to the old normal. So actually, we won and they lost. And that, I think, is extremely important to realize, because the media don't announce something good happening. They only talk and write about bad things happening. So we tend to be transfixed and mesmerized by all these bad things going on. But, you know, like, if you remember the early days of the pandemic, you know, they were, you know, people like Bill Gates and Fauci and so forth, they were saying, like, no, we're never going back to the old normal until everybody is vaccinated. And then, you know, we were supposed to get our vaccine passes and everything was going to be conditional, and we're going to have to show it everywhere you go. And it all fell away because it simply couldn't stick. Because, you know, even without any fanfare and anything spectacular happening, the people saw through the narrative. They realized that they were being deceived, and there you lose the enforcement muscle. You know, like, your enforcement claws turn to jello, and you can't push the narrative any further. And I think that the best possible parallel, metaphor that I've heard about is the Confucian saying that says, like, when a large tree falls, it falls with a lot of noise and great destruction, but seeds, they grow silently. And I think that this is kind of applicable to what we saw, because in everything that's going on, it's the old structures that are collapsing, and it's mesmerizing to observe. And I think we're all kind of hypnotized and absorbed in it. But the seeds that are growing are a millionfold more powerful, except, you know, we take them for granted because they grow in silence. And I think that those seeds are us, you know, us having this conversation, us researching, people like Rashid Buttar and many, 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 many others. I think there's tens, if not hundreds of thousands of us, or millions of us, and each one in their own time, within their own, you know, stage and level of awakening. But we are growing, and I think that we will prevail.
Well, I totally agree. Of course we will. I think you're absolutely right. It's going to get worse. It's going to get more more of these crazy things coming down the line. But ultimately, they're on a hiding to nothing. I love that expression, because what they're trying to do is fight, as I said earlier, an unwinnable battle certainly with the Russians, but also with their own population. And I think any kind of regime, as they like to call the Russian regime, any kind of regime that does that is doomed to fail. There's only a certain amount they can go. I remember always reading the resignation letter of George Orwell from the BBC World Service. It was during the Second World War. And he said, well, look, you know, I can carry on doing this propaganda, but I know that it's only a very short-term solution. Ultimately, it's going to fail, so I'm resigning. And Manfred Petrich, who was one of the people who used to come along until a couple of years ago when he died, whose father was a Nazi jet engine designer, put it like this. He said, well, the stuff they're putting out now in the press is for the stupid people. Everybody that's actually intelligent and knows what's going on, they take no notice of this at all. And there's an attempt to intimidate people like us, but we just carry on doing our thing. I'd just like to wind up with a quick thing about the Bilderbergers and COVID, because Robin at Wikispooks has done a fantastic job. He's got a whole page where he goes through, and this is one of those little sort of, let's take a long view back at the pandemic. 150 Bilderbergers have played important parts in the COVID-19 event, as he calls it. Many, perhaps most of the below, have been active in various roles. This page attempts to list them in the most important roles played. The steering committee members of Bilderberg are underlined. So I'm not going to name all the names, but in the virus research and development, big inverted commas around that, the pandemic planning, the task forces, the national task forces, the handlers, the social change, the lockdowns, the furlough schemes, the digitalisation, the masks, the ventilators, the social distancing, the track and trace, the academia controlling the narrative, the big media, the promoting of panic, the all opinion polling, the censorship, the vaccines, the research and development of those we just heard about, the viruses, the vaccines too, sidelining repurposed drugs, liability evasion, products and distribution, uncritical promotion, scapegoating of non-recipients, mandatory, making it mandatory as the Germans did just before the pandemic hit, the vaccine passports, the Great Reset, the French COVID Debt Commission, the COVID hands outs, the digital identity, and there is a final category for the unproven or unclear roles. And you can have a good old look at that. I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. We'll have Jackie Devoy next week. No time for our break this week. We've got such a good line of guests here and lots to talk about. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Also, the blogger. And what was your Substack again?
The Purposeful Path.
The Purposeful Path. That's Natalie Minnis. Alex Craner, the author of The Grand Deception, also speaking on Sunday at this conference in Bath, which is called...
Better Way Conference.
The Better Way Conference. Okay. Do please send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll also find the podcast, full-length interviews, story tips, and comment page, and our email address is at thisweek.org.uk. Thanks very much to the hard, struggling and hard-working sound engineer Dave Bazanko too. Have a relaxing and enjoyable bank holiday. No, that's not this weekend, that's last weekend. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream at talkradio.org.uk and on the app next Friday. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.